We'll call the meeting to order. It's
6:03.
Want to thank everybody for coming tonight. We're gonna take the proposed Coast Guard anchorage grounds issue. We'll take that out of order because I know there's quite a few people here that are interested in talking about that. And on such a beautiful night, we'll let you guys get out of here.
Can we also do the plastic bag legislation
sure.
right after?
Sure. Yeah. The resolutions we're voting on are just appointments to the EMC, and they're not really. There's not much discussion that goes on with them, so we can do that at the end. So we're going to do the proposed new business. We're going to about the Coast Guard anchorage grounds, and Ed Kelly is here. Thank you for coming. Edward Kelly is from he's the executive director of the Maritime Association of the Port of New York and New Jersey, and I believe John Lipscomb is going to come. He's supposed to be here from the captain of the Riverkeeper to talk about the issue. So. Hi, guys. So, I guess we'll open it up. Tracy, any questions? John, do you want to... How do you guys want to start this out?
I think probably the best... Mr. Kelly wanted to get... I mean, they're the ones who have requested these anchored points to the Coast Guard, is my understanding.
Yes, we have.
Wanted to provide a brief summary of your reasoning, and we can move from there.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
Is that okay, John?
We'll
give you the
absolutely.
Floor?
Absolutely.
Or Edward.
I think you'll find in your packet is the original petition to the Coast Guard from our Tug and Barge Committee, just as backdrop.
January 21st.
That was the original petition to the Coast Guard. Coast Guard took that petition under consideration, and seeing that it required some work and would impact the navigable channels, they, as is usual, they put out an advance notice of proposed rulemaking, and that opens up a public comment period so that any interested parties can comment on the proposed rules. I think the closure on the public comment is currently set at September 7th. It has been open since June, we don't make those rules. The Coast Guard makes those rules. They're standard federal Coast Guard rules. If anybody needs an extension of that period or any other thing, they need to approach the Coast Guard. That's beyond our purview. There have been substantial responses to this. One of the reasons I'm here is just to answer any questions and work with this. I would also have to say that based on the 260-some-odd responses that have gone to this docket so far, we as an industry were rather surprised because we view this as a rather routine type of procedure. We also wanted to address what we have seen in a lot of these public comments as either misinformation, disinformation, or just a need for a further discussion. So we're here tonight to offer that. Just as a background, since 1873, the Maritime Association of Port of New York has been involved as a primary advocate for the commercial maritime industry in the Port of New York and New Jersey, and we generally work cooperatively right up the Hudson River since it is an estuarine port and there is significant commercial operation. We represent almost exclusively commercial maritime interests. My membership of a little over 540-some-odd paid members includes deep-sea international shipping lines, marine terminals, organized longshore labor, draymen, the Port Authority of New York, New Jersey, admiralty attorneys, marine underwriters, divers, ship vessel repair companies, tug and barge owners and operators, maritime pilots, docking pilots, and just a host of other people involved in the commercial maritime business, either on the water itself or in the offices, agents, documentation people, etc. So we've been doing this for quite some time, since 1873,
wow.
And we're quite proud of doing that. We also operate as a marine exchange, which means we record all deep-sea vessel arrivals, departures, and shifts within the port. We've been doing that since our inception, and that information we tabulate into set data sets, and that's made available to people like the Coast Guard, the Maritime Administration, Customs and Border Protection, a host of federal, state, municipal offices, offices of emergency management, first responders, et cetera, as well as for commercial competitive purposes. Various lines will buy our data to see what their competitors are doing. And, you know, if they've made a contract with someone to provide 100% service, they want to make sure that that's what they're getting. So we sell that data. That's one of our revenue streams. Our interest in this particular proceeding is that a very significant tug and barge business operates in the Port of New York, New Jersey. I think you'll find in your packet is also attached our actual letter of support to this docket. And I think there are some significant points that look there. If you do peruse some of that, you'll see the economic impact that the port and international trade has on our communities. The entire United States, as well as the state of New York, the Hudson River, and each of these individual communities. The Port of New York and New Jersey, if just very quickly, handles over $208 billion of cargo value, over 640,000 vehicles, 5.8 million TEUs of general cargo. We are actually the United States' largest petroleum port because of the population. The Northeast is an affluent area with a very large population. And since people we have found do like to heat their homes, they like to have the electric lights turn on, they like to be able to put gas in their cars, they also like to have salt to put on the roads in the winter times. They like construction material to deal with. They like to put aggregates down. So there's a tremendous amount of this cargo that does move, and significantly, a significant portion of particularly bulk or heavier cargoes move by water. That's by either smaller coastal vessels or by tug and barge combinations. And that's primarily what we're here to discuss tonight with the Hudson River. Very important, these industries provide jobs. They provide good-paying jobs that are support families and that have full benefits. The majority of our workforce on tug and barge operations are union people, and they have excellent jobs, quite frankly. That supports the jobs at the oil terminals, the truckers who call at those terminals, as well as the various distribution and the ability to deliver these products at a reasonable cost so that gasoline, other prices, home heating oil, the price is lower because it moves by water. Water is the cheapest way to move freight. Is the most secure way to move freight as far as security versus people with hostile intentions. It's also the environmentally most friendly way to move this type of material. It's much safer than putting it in trucks. One small barge actually can replace 57 trucks, and we can one barge replaces as many as a dozen rail cars. Additionally, since the Oil Pollution Act back in 1990, every barge that's operated in the river is double-hulled. That means that they're double-skinned, that you could actually puncture the bottom of one of these barges, and there is a subsequent redundant hull in there. We're very safe. We're very well-structured. People talk about the potential of oil spills. What people are not talking about is actual oil spills, because this is an exceptionally safe industry that's highly regulated by various federal, state, and municipal organizations that make constant inspections as far as security. Everything moving on this domestic business moves under the Federal Jones Act that mandates that the crew must be 100% American citizens. Every one of those people has to pass and obtain a TSA, Transportation Security Administration, under Homeland Security, has to obtain a Transportation Worker Identification Credential, which does extensive criminal and drug background. We actually have a higher criteria than most police forces, and those are the people on the ships. That just gets them where they're eligible to serve on these ships as crew. They then have to have all the adequate training. They have to pass Coast Guard standardized federal testing, and then they can get the actual time on the ship. Masters of tugboats, mates, have got to have time in license and experience before they can sit for their next license. These are very highly trained people. This is an industry that is very closely supervised by the Coast Guard. The subchapter M has just come into effect. That means all tug and towing equipment is mandated to be inspected by Coast Guard on a minimum annual basis. These are not just people casually running up and down that are going to spill oil. People are talking. We're afraid Everybody is afraid, and our proposal here is based on increasing safety in this river. If you do take a look through these pieces, you'll see that we also have included into your packets, I don't know if anybody else, general people have got these, but we also just incorporated a couple of others that we felt were very important. The Hudson River Pilots Association, which strongly supports this proposal. The Sandy Hook Pilots Association. These are New York State licensed pilots who are responsible for the safe navigation of this business, and these people give some excellent reasons why these are important. What I would have to say is some of the misinformation we have seen is that this is going to create huge numbers of tankers and they're going to be storage facilities. I would ask you to please refer to the Coast Guard piece that I reiterates each of the various anchorage locations. As you will see, they're providing space for one vessel, two vessels, four vessels on a temporary basis. Very frankly, these types of operations have been happening in this river for centuries. There's a fellow named Hudson that the river is named after. He came here over 400 years ago on a commercial venture. Over the past decades, vessels have been operating on the river, bringing these goods based on the needs of Hudson River and regional people to consume heating oil, petroleum products, gas for your car, gas, fuel for power facilities that generate electricity, sand, salt. I've heard there's some snow you guys get up here periodically, and the sand and salt sometimes is handy on a road. This is the stuff that's moving. It's been moving for decades and decades, if not centuries, of actual operation. One of the biggest economic spurts in the United States was the Erie Canal opening in 1830 that really just, you know, this has been a busy commercial barge operation river ever since then. These tugs and barges are moving right now. This is not somebody's idea. Let's try this out. We are here today because we're trying to formalize under a federal statute these anchorage areas which for decades, if not centuries, have been used in common usage and common practice. Tugs, barges, coastal ships have been using these anchorages. These anchorages have been selected for several reasons. Well, first, why do these guys want to anchor at all? They only get paid when they're moving cargo. Transportation companies get paid to transport. There is no intent for storage, and I'll get into that. These people stop these boats for several reasons. The Hudson River at various times of the year is susceptible to fog. Fog means reduced visibility. There is also severe heavy weather, summer thunderstorms, etc. We've all been out in our car. And if you can't see more than 100 yards ahead of you, neither can the guys operating on the river. The Hudson River is subject to seasonal disturbances. That's a polite way of saying there's ice in the river at varying times of the year, where people have to anchor waiting Coast Guard icebreakers or for heavy breakage to pass. There are periodically equipment concerns that people need to get out of the main channel and anchor until that can be addressed and repaired. And there are various issues that maybe a berth is occupied and they can't move into that berth till the other ship moves out. These are temporary anchoring situations. Very frankly, it is in everyone's interest for these guys to have adequate anchorage area, because the last thing in the world any of us, everybody in this room, no one wants vessels to be operating in the Hudson River when they don't have good visibility, if they're impaired for any reason. We don't want them to anchor in the navigable channel. That's an accident begging to happen. So we have picked, they're really in over 100 miles of the Hudson River, there are no formal federal anchorages. The reason is because usual custom and practice has prevailed over the past centuries. There has not been a need to designate these. Coast Guard looked at it, and as part of their safety program, said they want federally regulated anchorage areas that are designated so that they have a better ability to manage, supervise, and look at these locations. Other than Hyde Park, there's really nothing available going up almost up into Kingston. What we did is we looked at areas, and the people that helped us to propose this are the Hudson River pilots and the actual tug and barge operators who do this every day for a living. And they looked at locations in the river that would be good anchorage locations. What makes a good anchorage location? You need to have sufficient water so that the vessels can move in and out without grounding and hitting the bottom. You need to have enough space that these vessels and these anchorages can swing, because with the change in the currents and sometimes down further river, the tide will change the direction of the flow of the river enough that they swing on the anchor a certain amount.
We live here too.
Yeah, you get that. The other thing that we're looking for is it has to be out of the current. You don't want to try to anchor in a bend in the river or in a very narrow spot where these anchorage locations could be subject to strong currents, which would have the ability to perhaps pull a vessel, drag it off an anchor, or have an adverse effect. So these are some, and the other piece is we want them to have a certain regularity of distance at intervals so that if bad weather sets in, somebody doesn't have to continue in bad weather. Now, Coast Guard was behind this when they came out and told us they'd prefer to have federal anchorages. We said we'd love to have federal designated anchorages, but we don't have any in this area. So they said, well, tell us what you need and where you need it. And that's how this proposal came about. This proposal is all about safety in this river, protecting the lives of people that are on the river, protecting the vessels that are engaged in trade, protecting the cargoes that are vital to our economy and livelihood up here, and also, very importantly, protecting the river itself. The Hudson River is cleaner than it's ever been before. We are a maritime community. There is nobody that values the water more than we do. That's how we make our living. We have some of the cleanest ways of moving freight. Our vessels use reduced sulfur fuel. We create fewer emissions than railroads or trucks. We have very strictly regulated emissions. We do not pump any type of sewage or any type of oily water. This is all trapped and contained on vessels. We are primary stewards of the health of the river. We operate there every day, and I challenge anybody to find any situation where we are actively doing anything to harm the river. View sheds. There are a number of people that are living along the river, and we understand. Some of them are thrilled with being able to see the traffic move up and down the river, and some of them don't like it. I would have to say that the Hudson River has been in continual commercial use since Henry Hudson arrived around 1620, I think was the date. And I hate to say it, but if you move next to an airport, you should have some recognition that you might see an occasional airplane. And as I said here, you can see that these federal anchorages are designed, and we can walk right down the list if anybody wants to waste a little bit of time, but the Coast Guard has indicated that these anchorages are designed for use by a minimal number of vessels of varying depths and operations. If I can just find it here.
That color map, if you flip.
Is it the color one?
No, there's a map on the top. Flip that open.
This one?
Yep. Yeah.
I was looking for the individual Coast Guard docket that was stipulating anchorage by anchorage.
That is on the orange one.
That's on the orange.
I think it starts on page.
Yeah, if people want to take a quick walk through the anchorages themselves.
It starts on page 5.
Yep, on page 5 of 7. Kingston Falls Flat, up to 3 vessels. Port Ewan, for 1 vessel. Big Rock Point, up to 4 vessels. Roaston, up to 3 vessels. I mean, this is not a huge number of vessels, and there's no projection that these are used to the fullest extent at every time. People are using these in the event of bad weather, reduced visibility, etc. And you can continue with that. There's 10 of them. Up to 2 vessels, up to 3 vessels, up to 5 vessels, up to 3 vessels. I mean, up to 3 vessels. The largest one is down in Yonkers, and that's quite a bit downstate, and that caters also to the fairly busy port of New York and New Jersey, where they actually, in events of storm, i.e. Sandy, ships, tugs, etc., for safety purposes by the captain of the port, are ordered upriver for temporary berthing so that they don't get damaged, they don't sink, they don't create pollution or any other issue. So the only one that has any significant number for people saying we're creating parking lots for vessels, and that we're going to create huge storage areas for crude oil, that's not what we're asking for. That is not our intent. We are here to publicly put ourselves out there and honestly say why we are here, what we want, and why we want it. And I think also in the packet, we incorporated more or less a string of reasons as far as key points pertaining to the area. We want to operate in a safe, secure, and environmentally protective manner. We think that the designation of these federal anchorage areas will do nothing more than formalize what has been custom and practice in this trade for decades, if not centuries. We want to have these anchorages because to operate safely, we need them. We need places to pull out when visibility is impaired. We need places to pull out if there's a congestion at a berth. We need a place to pull out and equip a quick repair if there's an equipment failure. We need a place if due to heavy weather there's crew fatigue and they need a safe place to pull out. These are essential safety issues. We're doing this not to pollute the river. If we pollute the river, very frankly, our companies go out of business and our executives go to jail. We are not people trying to pollute this river. You will not find anybody making more strenuous efforts to protect this river and to keep it oil-free. We have seen a lot of scare tactics. As I say, people have said, we're going to create huge storage facilities. The anchorages do not provide for that. Does anybody think that a temporary anchorage for up to one or two or three vessels is a huge storage area? These are in places that have been in current usage and practice. We're not looking to bring in a lot of new stuff. We've seen people say that this is going to damage the sturgeon. If I could, I think I can quote the one section I thought was rather interesting that, let's see who this was from, the boat blogs, I'm trying to see who actually filed this. Oh, this is Riverkeeper. Two endangered species, short-nosed and Atlantic sturgeon, live in the Hudson. The river off Hyde Park, where there is a large federally sanctioned anchorage area, for example, may have the highest concentration of Atlantic sturgeon on the entire eastern seaboard. I've had discussions with people at the Hudson River Foundation who have said they don't really know enough about sturgeon to make a definitive statement either way, and although they kind of bite their tongue when they say it, they say that maybe some of the ruts and the disturbance of the bottom is creating prime spawning ground for the sturgeon in the Hudson River. We have one established federal anchorage in the Hudson River down here at Hyde Park, and that is the highest concentration of sturgeon they can find. How can they say that an anchorage is bad for sturgeon? You know, so there's a lot of misinformation, contradictory information, and unsubstantiated claims. So we're here to honestly say what we're doing. The documents that have been filed accurately state what we want. It accurately states why we want it. And we feel that the primary reason for these is a safety-driven necessity. The Coast Guard is insisting that federal anchorages are designated, not just usual custom and practice, because all these tankers have been anchoring in these areas for decades and decades without a problem. Coast Guard wants to formalize it. Why? Because Coast Guard is driven to increase, continually increase safety and security. If these federal navigation anchorage are established, Coast Guard will have a primary responsibility to supervise them, to ensure that people are properly anchoring, to ensure vessels are in the right location, and to ensure that the equipment is in good condition while it's there.
Great.
That puts more of a burden on us to operate responsibly, and we welcome it. We need safety spots to pull these barges and coastal tankers to the side for safety reasons, not for storage. If you look, these things are almost exclusively saying short term. That means Coast Guard says you have to be out of there in like 12 hours. That's not a storage facility, and one or two possible barges is certainly not a commercial area. Where oil is stored, it is stored down in the port of New York at the big oil tanks. I'm from New Jersey. Everybody can laugh now. Anybody that drives on the Jersey Turnpike goes through all those tank farms. That's where the oil is stored. Other facilities for local storage are on the ashore tank farms. I can guarantee that nobody wants to pay the amount of money we charge for a tug, a barge, and a crew at union wages, burning fuel the entire time, there's a lot cheaper and better ways to store oil than to keep it on the water. Does it make sense? It's just operationally not feasible. People don't store that stuff on the water, certainly not up in a river environment where there is limited availability for anchorages to do it. It's done down in the deep water ports, or it's done at the local oil terminal at destination. The oil is not sent up the river if those terminals don't need it. So as I say, if you guys want to turn off the lights, you want to stop driving your cars, you don't want to heat your homes in the wintertime, you don't want any more salt and sand for the roads, don't buy it. You'll see that the demand will drop, and correspondingly the number of barges and tanks and others will dry up. I can guarantee you don't want to see trucks and rails moving this product. Rail has had accidents with this crude already. They're single hull, not double hull. When they have a problem, the oil leaks. It's all over the place. You also don't want millions of trucks carrying this heavy material through your neighborhoods and parkways, increasing road congestion, and these heavy trucks that would have to be used to replace this have almost unmeasurable wear and tear on your infrastructure. Heavy trucks like this tear up the roads, and they beat bridges to death. The amount of tax money to repair all of that would be huge. As I say, waterborne transit in New York City, the New York City Economic Development Corporation did a study in 1 year. Waterborne transport of bulk materials just within New York City eliminated 3.1 million truck moves. I don't think you want to see those trucks coming through your neighborhood because they emit a lot more than we do. Water is the cleanest, most environmentally friendly way to move. That's my story. I'm sticking with it, and if anybody has a question, I'll be more than happy to address
it. Do you mind taking some questions from the committee?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Legislator Bortles?
Okay.
Thank you.
So you talk about, and I'm getting up to speed on all this in the last week or so only. So you talk about formalizing what's been customary for years, and one of the letters that you provided from the Hudson River Pilots Association references the need to codify because in late 2015 there were shoreside complaints about anchored barges. So is the need to codify, is that accurate? Is the need to codify because of complaints or what had been past standard practice outside?
Coast Guard throughout the United States has been on a bend to formalize anchorages. Were they responding to it? You know, they get complaints all the time from all sorts of people. Sometimes people object to lighting. Sometimes we've had...
And that was my next question.
We have had... I hate to say it. We've had a state senator put on his website totally inaccurate information, saying that these barges are unmanned and unlit. Not true. The Coast Guard and the federal law requires to be in compliance with the rules of the road and federal navigation law. These things are manned. These things are attended by tugboats with full crews, and they are all lit in accordance with the rules of the road.
And let me ask a question about that. So
we have people complaining they're not lit, they are, and we have people complaining they are lit, which they are by law. So when
these vessels are anchored, they're lit, and they stay lit, that would mean through the night.
So navigation lighting.
Okay.
Yes.
And are they running? Is there what kind of noise pollution is there? Is that something that you've heard complaints from or about shoreside?
Have we ever heard someone complain about it? Yes. Have we heard enough that we think it's significant or that it really creates a problem? Probably not. And again, we have to go back to the resounding airport law. When you move close enough to an airport, you have to expect you're going to see some airplanes. Will you sometimes hear noise? Yes, you will. That's kind of part and parcel. I hate to say it, but commercial navigation in this river predates anybody living on it other than Native Americans. Is it a big problem? Not really. Tugboats, barges don't make any noise. They're inert. They're not power units. Their navigation lights are kind of like the taillights on a truck. If you're very close to them, you'll see them. They got a picture of a tanker operating at night with those types of lights, but usually required navigation lights are a white light high fore and aft if they're at anchor. They're the only two lights that are necessary. Can there be some deck lighting? Yes, if there are any nighttime operations going on. Does that happen frequently? No. So, yes, there can be occasions where somebody will see lights, and you can hear a tugboat. Generally, people don't get close enough to hear tugboats, very honestly. A tugboat operating in navigable channel, you're probably not even going to hear. All I can do to evaluate that is, yeah, tugboats make noise if you get close enough to them. They make the noise of about a diesel truck.
Okay.
So, you know, would you say, does a diesel truck make a lot of noise? Well, depends on how close you are to it. And we, again, have to say the economic benefit of these versus the NIMBY concept, don't put it in my backyard.
While they're at anchor,
yes.
Using the Hyde Park because that's already designated,
mm-hmm.
is there a maximum amount of time that they can stay? You mentioned something
about Coast Guard monitors. And generally, Coast Guard flushes. We call it flushes anchorages. They usually try to make everything move within 12 hours. If you're staying any longer than that, you have to be in touch with Coast Guard, and you generally have to have a reason for that. Now, if somebody is there and they're waiting for a part to be delivered so they can effect a repair because something broke or something, then Coast Guard will let them stay. If you tell them you're there waiting for the price of oil to change, as some people have suggested, I mean, who's going to pay for a tug, a crew, it's an exorbitant cost. It doesn't make sense to store stuff or to have somebody sitting there for a month or two waiting for the price of oil to change. A lot of it just doesn't make sense. It's speculation. Coast Guard flushes these anchorages fairly quickly. The industry also encourages rapid turnover of these anchorages because when vessels need an anchorage, they want the anchorage to be available.
But there's nothing in writing with a maximum stay time?
No. Not at this point. It's usual Coast Guard practice, which is usually 12 hours, and then they want to know what you're doing there.
Thank you.
I thank you for coming here. I think to start, one of the reasons why, rightfully so, there has been so much public concern is just the public input process.
Sure.
Understandably, residents are concerned with the idea that their only input may just be filing a comment on a website with the Coast Guard. So I do commend you for being here, but I think those folks that would like a greater presence, especially from the Coast Guard as well, for more community involvement in this process and the ability to speak, like I said, rather than just filing a comment on a website. So I think that's part of the concern. And also just understanding our community's history with the Hudson River. We are a community that has had our river abused in the past by corporate interests, specifically General Electric. We have a river that's still not clean, in my opinion and experts' opinions, because of years of pollution. So I think that also is a reason, and rightfully so, for so much concern, specifically within Ulster County. First, with the statements you made about the Coast Guard wanting to have more oversight over these anchorage points, Ulster County, as you may know, also is a throughway for CSX trains.
Mm-hmm.
A concern that's been lingering for a long time is the inability for local communities to react should an accident with one of these CSX trains happen in our community. Our first responders are not equipped. If the Coast Guard, again, this might be more, but it's important for the folks that you represent as well, is trying to have more oversight and ensure the safety. If we are going to have these vessels, some coming in because of the reasons of possible malfunctions and mechanical problems, what reassurances, support, protocol will be in place for communities like the city of Kingston, town of Saugerties, to respond should there be an accident at one of these or an event at mm-hmm. one of these anchoring stations?
I think it's three things. First, public hearings. This is a standardized Coast Guard procedure. It's not my procedure.
Yeah, I understand that. I was just
the Coast Guard
expressing why
for that.
I believe
Coast Guard then, Avon District 1, which supervises these Coast Guard sectors, based on the amount and the type of public response in these public comments, then takes the next step, and they will decide if they need or want to have public hearings, if there's substantial issues raised. That's up to the Coast Guard. You know, if there is a Coast Guard reaction and they've got a very substantial amount of information here, the Coast Guard can and will hold public hearings. There's a huge geographic area. There are a lot of people involved. Coast Guard generally will have, you know, several public hearings at kind of scattered locations where they will open it up and they'll expand that record, and then they will go back into their Coast Guard castle someplace and decide what to do. We have no impact on that.
Yeah,
we are more than willing. I'm sitting here. I drove a little over 2 hours, and I actually put on a tie today, which maybe I didn't have to.
No.
Oh, and shame on you. You should have told me. But, you know, I put on a tie and I came up here because we are open. We are entirely open to this. We have documented exactly what we want. We have said why we want it. We are here to answer questions and to dispel a lot of misinformation or disinformation that's been out there. The second one, corporate abuse. I don't think there's any question about that. ExxonMobil contaminated Gowanus Inlet. You know, we've got a huge problem with Newtown Creek with fuel spilled. It's not us.
Yeah.
We're not the maritime interest. These are shore-based things. I mean, I know the Hudson still has problems with pesticides. There's still a lot of reasons. The good news, the Hudson is cleaner than it's been in 100 years, and we're getting better. The CSX, I can give you names in the CSX, have them come up here and talk to you. The reality is the CSX, the rail transport of crude, is not as safe as water. They are single-hulled. And they tend to have more moving parts, if you will, as far as derailment, collisions, et cetera. Across the country, water transport has a much safer record of transport than does the rail. And it's head and shoulders above the motor industry. So I think, you know, those are some issues that are out there. Public hearing?
Well, Michael,
we're here.
Most of that was, you know, background expressing our concern, but at these the main question that's most important, specific to these anchor points, is what protocol is in place
for
a reaction?
Just absolutely. The best way to respond to an accident is not to have one. That's why we want these anchorages. We want to take these cargoes, these people, their lives, recreational boaters, human-powered boaters, everybody that's using this river, the fish, everybody involved, we want to keep them safe. Rather than proceeding in restricted visibility, heavy weather, or under duress where they might be operating with something broke and they just need to get it fixed up a bit, they'll have a chance to pull over and get it addressed. I'd liken this to you driving in your car. If you're driving in very severe fog, if you're driving in a summer thunderstorm and you can't see 50 yards ahead and there's a lot of water sloshing around and it's a little bit unsafe, especially if you're in a situation where there's veering traffic, what do? You slow down and you look to get off the road until it's a safer condition.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we want to do. We want to get out of dangerous situations, take the people, the vessels, the cargo, and protect the river. That's why we want. So step one, increase safety, get people out of harm's way. That's the first way. The second way is the waterborne transport has some very rigid and very well-delineated operations as far as spillage goes. I can get into some of this. It's going to be a little more techy than you want regarding booms, standby tugs, rescue vessels, and the training of all these people as well as Coast Guard. There are very rigorous, particularly for petroleum or chemical products. There are very specific rules governing public transportation that are both federal and state, and I would just invite you to put yourself at ease. Take a look at those statutes. They're very extensive. Take a look at the training that our crews have, that they have to have certification for oil spill response before they can get a job on one of these tugs, before the Coast Guard will give them their certification to be a watchstander or to be a crew member. There are criminal liabilities that run right up into executive offices, never mind just the people on board the boats. These guys, the presidents of these companies, go to jail if somebody does something irresponsible or contrary to law, and you can read the federal records, there have been people that, I mean, shoreside executives that never step on a boat, and away they go. These transportation companies are impeccable about how they handle that. As far as response, there are response capabilities on a federal and an industry basis. I think it would be productive if you folks have capabilities with first responders to exercise those first responders with federal and industry folks. We do that on a regular basis. We've done that in various locations. We do all the time with New York City. We do joint exercises out the wazoo. We do terrorists. I mean, everybody saw it. It's a movie with Tom Hanks. Sully came down in the river. How do you think that all those vessels were on spot this quick, had an established communication basis, had been in touch for the drift of the river so they could already predetermine the best place to monitor and drag this plane as it moved down the river so it would have the least impact on the river, reduce the spills, put out the booms, and had the proper life-saving equipment to get from ferries and tugs to get onto these things so all those people could walk off? Do you think it was an accident that those people were taken out of that disaster and not a single person was lost? We exercise this all the time. And very frankly, if your communities did not exercise these options with your first responders, shame on you. We are partners. We do it routinely. We've done it up in Albany. We've done it in New York all the time. We've done it with Yonkers. We have a host, a list like this. We are very receptive to jointly operating and to work with and educate first responder organizations. Very frankly, if our ass gets in trouble, they're the guys that will help us out. We like them to be very good at what they do. So we would encourage that. In your capacities as legislators in this county, I think you should ask your first responders, have they exercised with the industry and with the Coast Guard for potential spill situations? And if they have not, why not, and when will they do it? We're receptive to that as an industry. We do it all the time.
Thanks.
Oh, I just have a question. I see that High Park is closed from December 16th through February.
I see.
So that would that be true of all of them?
No, that one. Others are subject to conditions. Now, again, one of the benefits of a federally designated anchorage area is the Coast Guard will then keep them ice-free. They will work on them to make them available. The one up there, it just tends to get iced in too much, too thick, too often to really make it effective to do significant ice work. District 1 Coast Guard runs the ice-breaking operation in the Hudson River. If they have designated areas, they will be able to do that. If we tell them, well, we might be anywhere along here, mostly here, but maybe over there, sometimes up there, they can't keep the entire river ice-free.
Right.
One of the benefits of the safety is the ice that the Hudson River does experience in varying degrees from season to season. And, you know, the designated anchorage makes Coast Guard able to target particular areas for ice-breaking operations, and that enhances the safety.
Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you. Do you want to...
I'll answer any question.
Do you want to let Mr. Kelly... Well, you know, we're not going to get into a discussion. I'd like to let John maybe speak, and then we can let people talk. It's not going to be... It's just an information session. It's not going to be... It's a committee meeting, because we have a lot of other stuff to go over. So do you mind... John Lipscomb?
John Lipscomb.
And then we'll let everybody.
He's with the River
Keeper. I work for River Keeper.
Yep.
And so I want to say there's a lot of information to discuss here, so I feel sorry for you poor guys. First of all, as a professional vessel operator, I want to go on record. It's very hard for me to sit on the opposite side of the table from another mariner. Very difficult. Nothing that I say here tonight should be taken in any way to suggest that there's anything but the absolute highest level of professionalism in the tug operators, the ship operators, the Hudson River pilots. They deserve nothing but admiration. They are operating extremely hazardous cargoes in some cases. They are operating extremely sophisticated vessels. They are like a 747 pilot calling the president all the time. So I want to be on the record that my respect for the industry is terrific. The problem here is that I have to divide loyalties, and for Riverkeeper and myself, the river has to come first. So it's important to get a little background on why we're here. There are two existing designated anchorages, one off Yonkers and one off Hyde Park, which we've been discussed. The anchorage between Rhinecliff and Port Ewan was in use in recent years, and that's the anchorage that generated the comments over lighting. Now, it's important, we've got to drill down, otherwise there's no way to understand. The vessels anchoring off Port Ewan really weren't taken notice of by anybody until about 2012. 2012 is when Bakken oil started coming out of the ground in the middle of the continent. And the Port of Albany has traditionally been a receiving port. Receives the salt. It receives heating oil. Receives gasoline. Receives diesel fuel. And that's what the petroleum transport has been. That's what the bulk transport has been. Used to be a banana boat that ran up the river when I was a kid. Big white ship. Scrap metal comes down. Crushed stone comes down. So there are a lot of commodities, as our colleague here has said. What happened in 2012 is that the facilities, and let's just say right off the bat, if this was a discussion about increasing traffic of crushed stone, we probably wouldn't be talking about it. So we'll come back to this. It's specific to a class of cargo, this conversation. What happened in Port Ewan Anchorage, I'll call it, is that as of 2012, northbound empty tug and barge units started anchoring because of congestion in the Port of Albany. Port of Albany had oil terminals, two main ones, Buckeye and Global, that were built to receive product. And all of a sudden, they're getting five unit trains a day down the Mohawk Valley, a couple down the Champlain. So millions and millions of millions of gallons of crude oil coming in. They're using tanks that were for storage of northbound product to be distributed into the upper parts of New York State and even into Vermont. Now they're using some of those tanks for storage of crude oil, and the docks aren't sufficient. They didn't build the Port of Albany anticipating for 30, 40 years ago this Bakken transport. So the Port of Albany gets short. So vessels were coming up to Kingston. And why Kingston? Why weren't they going closer? It's important to understand. My colleague here, he understands perfectly, but it's important to say why. North of Kingston, the river has many channel sections that are dredged channels that are fixed width. There isn't swinging room of a large vessel at anchor, really north of the Port Ewan Line Cliff, the Kingston Hub, as it's described in this proposal. And so what happened is vessels started anchoring off Kingston, off of Port Ewan. The public started hearing generators. So one of the assertions was that the barges are inert. Barges have big generators on deck, and the barges are running what the public in Rhinecliff referred to as stadium lighting. And in our email that I think you guys have probably received, we have a photo taken from Rhinecliff at night, and we have lots of this stuff. And so this is typical of what an empty riding light crude oil barge will be lit like. Now, I can't say, because I'm not in this class of vessel operation, why a petroleum barge is lit with arc lamps like this. But the generators to run those lights are running, and people are hearing it in their houses when they have their windows open. So that drove this conversation. If for some reason there hadn't been lighting and there hadn't been generators, we might not be here today. Because those people went to the Coast Guard and said, this is driving us nuts. Coast Guard said, well, that's not a problem, in a nice way they said. But in the course of the conversation, it was found that that Kingston hub, the Port Ewan Anchorage, was not a designated anchorage. So in a letter, November 9, 2015, the Coast Guard notified commercial shipping that that Port Ewan Anchorage was no longer to be used. And I think that that drove the request to ministry. And again, I have to say, I'm all in favor of this industry. The safety record of the industry, the professionalism of the industry is undisputed. The thing that's under dispute here is whether there should be more anchorages and laws, not the quality of the operator or the vessel. Okay. And not that they have every legitimate reason to run a business and try to run more business. All accepted. So that led to the Coast Guard coming out with their, the industry coming out with their letter from September, I think it is, and that led to the Coast Guard being a broker. So the Coast Guard, and a lot of the press right now, the Coast Guard is being called, it's Coast Guard proposal. And a lot of people are angry at the Coast Guard. Actually, that's misplaced as well. The Coast Guard is doing exactly what we want them to do. The Coast Guard has come out with this advanced notice of proposed rulemaking, which means this isn't even the proposed rulemaking. This is they're taking the temperature of you all and everyone else and the industry, finding out the industry's need, the community's reaction to the proposal. It's not even a proposal. If it goes forward, it could be that the Coast Guard will say, this is not a good plan. We've received input that leads us to believe it's not a good plan, and they could shut it down right now. They could also come back with a modified plan, which says, okay, there are 10 proposed anchorage grounds. We're going to consider, based on input, we're going to consider a limited number of these, or we're going to restrict, or we're going to modify. They could also come back and say, we're going to consider the proposal in full. At that time, everyone gets to comment again. But this is the point where the public and the communities have to say what's on their mind. It doesn't have to be a legal document. It doesn't have to be hard science. It says, here are the questions we have at this point in the project. And I should say, again, I'm giving the Coast Guard credit because they're getting maligned. And it's a bad thing to malign the Coast Guard in this case because they don't have every excuse then to say, oh, well, the public can't work with them, the hell with it. So this is a time where we have to actually show respect. It's in striking contrast to what happened in 2012 when New York State and D.C. and Governor Cuomo allowed the throughput of the Port of Albany to go from 450,000 gallons of crude oil a year to 3 billion without any public hearings, without any CEQA review, without an EIS, only considering air emissions. So the oil that's blowing up in communities across the United States, the explosions were not considered, the spills were not considered, the possibility of a rail spill is not considered, the possibility of a barge spill or a ship collision is not considered. So the disservice was done to us in 2012 by New York State, our people. The villains are not industry, the villains are not the Coast Guard. So, take it from the top. What is confusing to the public is that the need is not clear. Bear with us. Bear with me. I've operated on a Hudson 16 years now, 4 or 5,000 miles a year. That's 20 days on the water from April to December. New York Harbor to Troy and Waterford, and then the Mohawk to Rome, and then Upper Hudson to Fort Edward. And so, you know, I go through these anchorages all the time. And I saw the vessels at Port Ewan. I see the vessels at the existing authorized anchorage at Hyde Park. I see vessels at Yonkers. Now, the Yonkers anchorage is never full. The Hyde Park anchorage is never full. And the Port Ewan anchorage sometimes had two, and I've heard reports of up to three. But the Kingston Hub is now talking about having capacity for eight. So what I'm getting at is that...
And the Ewan is
I'm saying the Kingston Hub, which is Port Ewan, Big Rock Point, and Kingston Flats.
And specifically, Port Ewan is seeking one vessel.
But to the public, that's one location, because that's within the viewshed of everyone in one location. It's nice that they're distinguished, but for the purposes of the public, it's one location. That's why it's referred to in the paperwork as the Kingston Hub. It's acknowledged to be one location with three grounds. But so in that hub, whether a vessel was anchored at the Flats or at Port Ewan or at Big Rock Point, I'm saying I've never seen more than three. And I've never had reported to me more than three, in spite of the public reporting to us since 2012 about their irritation at the lighting and the noise. They're not irritated by the vessels or the tugs. They're irritated by the noise and the light. So if it was stone boats out there with no deck lights and no generators, we probably wouldn't be talking. Stone boat is a, you know, hopper barge with wrapped crushed stone. So what I'm getting at here is the need has never been demonstrated. We see the I've never seen, except once, more than six vessels anchored in the entire estuary. So why? I've never seen, except once, vessels anchored at the upper end of Havistraw Bay, at Montrose, or at Tompkins Cove, except once at Newburgh and Marlborough and Roseland. And I'll tell you that once was during Sandy. During Sandy, I was up north, and I had an old father and a kid down south, so I came south to meet the storm, because I figured I knew I could handle it in my marina. But all the commercial traffic was going north, from tugs to Coast Guard vessels to naval vessels, and they were anchored at the upper end of Havistraw Bay, Montrose. They were anchored in Yonkers. They were anchored in Tompkins Cove. They were anchored at Newburgh. They were Marlborough, Roseland. Every one of these locations had vessels. Why? Because the mariners are prudent. They wanted to get out of New York Harbor where the wind was going to be the greatest. Hurricane winds diminish as they go over land. And they were asked to by the Coast Guard, which runs a very sophisticated...
Told. Captain of the port order.
Asked to. Told. Ordered. Commanded. Do it. But all these anchorages were in use. So when there was an emergency situation, the Coast Guard had no problem authorizing the use of these anchorages. I'm talking now about the need, okay? I've heard various statements from, and I'm not going to name names, because I'm not interested in throwing individuals under the bus. I've been told in the conversations the last 2 weeks, we want to anchor in that Kingston hub because we only want to transit north during daylight with our product. And so then I brought up that, first of all, I see vessels going through there at night, northbound, with refined product. And second, I see crude oil being loaded in the Port of Albany and coming down any time of day or night. Now, it's not a theory I have. We have a ship spotter in Poughkeepsie whose business it is to track vessels. So here's the Dean Reinhauer in the middle of winter with ice on the river coming through at 1 a.m. at Poughkeepsie. That means he went through that upper reach. Poughkeepsie's 14 miles south of Kingston. Went through that upper reach at night. Ice on the water. Here's one that came through at 6 a.m. Here's one that came through at 11. So the fact of the matter is, the upper reach, which I was told for safety purposes, the anchorages are needed in the Kingston Hub because we only want vessels to transit that upper section in daylight. The problem we're having is that that doesn't ring true. It doesn't ring true. It doesn't match the facts on the ground. The vessels that stay in Kingston can sometimes stay many days, many daylights. And we've documented petroleum product moving southbound without any restriction. So what it amounts to, and I can go on, but I'm just at the beginning. And it's very, because it's very complicated. If you don't understand it, then we shouldn't discuss it. We should discuss it well or not at all. But the problem here is not safety in the upper reach. And if it is, then the Coast Guard, which requires separation lanes as ships approach New York Harbor from Ambrose. There's three different separation lanes, inbound, outbound lanes. They have vessel traffic control in the Port of New York. They manage movements of all these vessels for safety to minimize the risk of collision. If that section of the river is risky, then let's not travel it at night. That's another solution besides anchorages. Anchorage isn't the only solution. But the fact of the matter is, I'm dealing with that allegation, that contention on face value. But the reality is, we have documentation of vessels traveling through that reach, loaded with every kind of product, petroleum product, day and night. Sure. So it's not about traveling in daytime. All right?
Nor is it prohibited or unusual to operate at night.
Right.
We're just saying that these anchorages need to be there in the event that there is enough ice or a situation,
right,
or if somebody feels they have a need to pull out.
Right. So
were there any problems, evidence that any of those people you took pictures of, were there spills, were there accidents?
I'm coming to that, but I can't have the conversation if it becomes a discussion.
No, I'm, you know,
I let you roll.
I don't want to turn into point counter.
I let you roll, and now I got to roll.
Go.
Okay, so the community, I don't think, would be reacting the same way if the request by industry was of the Coast Guard to designate these areas as emergency anchorages to be used upon approval of the Coast Guard. That's what we saw in Sandy. If it was emergency authorization, I am eager. I've worked very hard with the Coast Guard over the last 3 years, as I will discuss when I get to the crew hour response business, because that's at the heart of this. It's the product that is scaring the crap out of the valley. But I found the Coast Guard to be very easy to work with, in spite of being a huge bureaucracy, and I would be eager in these hearings that we hope to have with the Coast Guard to ask them, is there a circumstance where you would get a call from a ship master or a tug master who says, I have a mechanical failure, or I can't see because of visibility, or I can't handle because of crosswinds, or whatever. If the master says it's unsafe to proceed, if the Coast Guard says to us, yes, we're not going to let you use these anchorages for emergency use, then we'll be on the same side of the table, and we'll be advocating for you. But right now, there's a big difference between emergency use, which is the status quo, and authorized, which is what's being proposed. And the thing that does not work and jive for many of us, for Riverkeeper or many of the people in the community, is the vast increase in bursts. The vast number. So as I say, I've never seen even a half dozen, and now there are 30 bursts at 10 locations, in addition to the existing bursts in the lower part of Yonkers and at Hyde Park. That's an enormous increase, and what's not clear is what's driving that. When there is, and I'm trying to be gentle, when there's misinformation like saying we can't travel the upper reach except in daylight, that makes the other information that the industry is providing less reliable. So what we really want to know is really what is driving this. Is it, as everyone suspects, a congestion in the Port of Albany, the low Bakken? The vessels that are anchoring are primarily Bakken. And is it congestion in the Port of New York, and that's why the biggest expansion is at the Yonkers area of 16 additional berths, all the way up to Dobson. So, I mean, I can go on and on, but that gives you an idea of why we're here. It demonstrates that...
When you're done, I have a question for you.
I won't be done for a day or so.
Well, when you're done with your thoughts, there.
Yeah, so I want to move to the specific risks, because I will be addressing some of the comments. So, lights and noise, we've talked about. We're hearing that there are no generators on the barges. We're hearing that they're lit with only navigation lights, anchor lights. But the reality is, you're seeing the reality, is that the petroleum barges are lit up like, the word I get is stadium light. So that's the reality.
Well, that's now, one picture.
It's one picture, but I have many,
Over many years, you know, so.
And the Marine Safety Information Bulletin came out specifically regarding this. Coast Guard specifically reminded, mariners are reminded of the lighting requirements for vessels as required by the inland navigation rules codified in 33 CFR 83 can be found. Additional deck lighting is authorized but should not interfere with the required navigation lighting. And Coast Guard came out with a notice on this. If somebody sees a ship that's lit up like a ballpark, call the Coast Guard. The Coast Guard will come and have them shut it off. There are people that can, you know, it's like any rule. There can be somebody that can do that. There can be one picture of a guy lit up. There can be 100 guys that we can show pictures that are, you know, black as night.
When the people in Rhinecliff and Fort Ewan were complaining to the Coast Guard about the lighting, that rule was in effect. But the barges, that rule was in effect. In other words, extraneous lighting, additional lighting that might obscure anchor lighting, because that rule was in effect. That's been in effect for years and decades and a century, perhaps. The point is, the Coast Guard did not tell the barges to turn on the lights. They told the community, that's the way it goes. The thing that drove the barges out of the Port Ewan anchorage was the fact that it wasn't an authorized anchorage, it wasn't the light. So we have seen, we have evidence, I'm not saying it's over the conversation, we can go back to the Coast Guard, we can discuss this as the text wrote. That's the point of the public hearings. But to finish on the noise and lights, because I put that first because it's actually the easiest. That's for every community to think of. The people in the community of Marlboro that have the Tilcon Clinton Point Quarry across the way that's lit up like Christmas, mm-hmm. and then a trash incinerator at Kruger,
Mall.
Then the IBM facility.
The mall.
And whatever. I have no idea whether they will look at the noise and light issue in a wider section of the river where there's more industry and have a reaction. That's for the communities to say. So Riverkeeper points it out only because that's what we're hearing from the public, and part of our job is to support the community. So that's there. The next issue is this issue of sturgeon, which is in our post. Okay. I know Dennis Lisowski at Dawson River Foundation. In fact, Riverkeeper's enforcement against an Exxon ship that was discharging petroleum-laced water at the Hyde Park Anchorage in the 70s funded the Hudson River Foundation through the penalties that Exxon
right.
paid.
Right.
So,
which was clearly violating the law,
right.
and who was prosecuted, and who paid millions of dollars, and who paid the price for violating the law,
right.
like anybody else would.
Right.
So I'd also mention that was 1970s, and the last I checked, it's 2016, and we're talking, you know, discharging oily water is substantially different than transporting oil. So
I'm not suggesting that
just
the same.
It's a little apples and oranges.
I'm saying that the Hudson River Foundation is well known to us, and we work closely with them. In fact, we're the reason they exist.
I know them very well. They're on the other side of my wall.
Listen, one quick thing. We've got...
Yeah,
I'm not going to short circuit anybody, but we're going to limit at 7:30. We're going to be we're going to be finished with
this
issue, and we're going to move on to plastic bags.
This
is a committee meeting. We can definitely have another hearing down the road. But I'm just saying it's 10 after now, so we have 20 minutes left, and then we're going to go.
I can't respond to you. Okay. So the deal on sturgeon is the following. It's not a theory. In the recent years, scientists from New York State, D.C., and Delaware have been using sonar imaging looking at tanker scarring in the Port Ewan Anchorage and at Hyde Park. They went to Hyde Park not looking for tanker scarring or scour. They went because it is the largest concentration of Atlantic sturgeon in the Northeast or in the Eastern Seaboard. The estimated population of Atlantic adult spawning age fish in the 2007 study, the last peer-reviewed study, was under 1,000 fish, and about 600 of them, 650, were males, and the rest were females. The population is on fumes. That's why they're on the endangered species list. So an area where they congregate is very important. Very important. The suggestion is made that the ships have been there, and it's the largest concentration, so it couldn't be hurting the sturgeon. If the ships weren't using it, there might be more. The point we make in our document is that before these anchorages are authorized, the one in Port Ewan, where short-nosed sturgeon overwinter, I'm talking to Kingston Hub in general, and the anchorages down at Verplank and Montrose, where both species overwinter, the science has to be done. That's all we're saying in our document. The science has to be done. We're not saying that the scour or the scarring of the bottom is detrimental. We're saying it has to be known. That's not just Riverkeeper. That's NOAA, National Marine Fisheries Service. That's DEC. I trust that DEC's comments are being vetted by the governor's office right now. But I work with all these people, so I know what they're going to come out with. And so it's just a question of knowing. That's concern number two. And it even puts at risk, frankly, I'm sorry to say, that Hyde Park anchorage is already authorized. It may be shifted, it might be shortened, it might be regulated to not be used when the sturgeon are there. Luckily, the sturgeon come in, they spend 3 months, and they split. So there are all kinds of formulas that can be put into play here as this moves forward, if it moves forward. The third major issue, which is probably what draws this crowd, is that the public sees these anchorages as a reindustrialization of the valley. And you're absolutely right that the valley has been used for business since Henry Hudson. But that's not an argument. There used to be whaling vessels off of Poughkeepsie and Hudson, but we don't whale anymore. And we used to take all of New York City's trash and take it offshore and dump it in from Scouse off New Jersey. We don't do that anymore. We used to have direct discharge from all our sewer plants.
Captain,
well, now we only do it part.
Enough with the face expressions. Right? Just sit and listen.
What's the matter?
No, just facial expressions. Just. All right. Well, this table's supposed to just be for the legislators and the guests and the speakers. Just, thanks.
I apologize. I didn't even know. What we did in the past isn't necessarily what we'll do again. This gentleman points out that GE did us a giant favor with PCBs. We have rail lines that have run up each shore and cut off most of our marshes and the huge areas of habitat cut off. The deepening of the channel up to the Port of Albany, when Henry Hudson came up, he ran aground at Stuyvesant at 8 feet or so, now it's 33 feet. All the dredging spoil was pumped out of the bottom to make that deep channel, and was pumped into the side channels. The ice charts from 1820, there was myriad channels up there, dozens and dozens of islands. Now 60 or 70% of the shallow water habitat from Hudson and Athens North is gone to make the Port of Albany work. I can go on and on and on and on. Exxon was given as an example in Newtown Creek in Greenpoint, largest underground spill, and that was a facility that used water transport. The legacy contamination from coal tar manufactured gas plants in Poughkeepsie and virtually all our communities along the river we're still dealing with at our expense. It goes on and on. So the public is at a different point in time than when Henry Hudson came in or early industry came in. And what we have now is a public that loves this river for other reasons than use. They love it for more than a resource. So the big issue here is that in the industry's letter to the Coast Guard, on page 3, it states, federally designated anchorages are key to supporting trade, meaning specifically the increase in crude oil, in crude oil. And that's where organizations like mine and others would come to a North Star. If it were up to Riverkeeper and many, many others in this valley, we would not be put at risk from the explosions or the spills posed by crude oil, because we profit not all. Certain individuals operating vessels profit, but the society, the 20 million people who live within 50 miles of New York City, do not profit from crude oil. The pumpers out at Dakota profit.
You know, John, can I say something? The reason they're going up the Hudson is because of all of us sitting here. We drive cars, we fly in airplanes.
Absolutely.
So,
not.
You know, it's a little disingenuous to say that 20 million people aren't creating the reason that those oil ships aren't in the port.
Absolutely.
We are the reason.
It doesn't say that the Bakken crude doesn't stay local in the Hudson Valley.
I'll explain. On face value, you're right.
There's more than Bakken crude.
I drove my car that burns gas.
Okay. We all do.
Okay, so now, before 2012, did I drive a car or did I have a buggy? Yes, I drove a car. You drove a car. So we had gas. The drive to get the oil out of the ground in North Dakota is not driven just by the need that you and I have driving our vehicles. It's a business. No problem. I understand business. But the business has to support its own risk. You have to look and see if those businesses, the trains or the vessels, insure themselves for a spill in the Hudson. No.
We see a lot of insurance.
They don't cover the cost of a spill, and I've been working 3 years with the Coast Guard on this issue. So the problem we have, it's bare saying, you bring a great point up. We had a barge a day and two trains a day coming down the Hudson before the prices collapsed. While the prices have been down, transport has dropped. Okay? It's market driven. While that happened, the export ban on crude oil was lifted. The feds lifted the crude oil ban, export ban that has been in place since the big oil crisis decades ago. When the price goes back up, the sky's going to be the limit. Because instead of just bringing down the Hudson, the oil that can get to the refineries in Linden and Philly, they're going to be bringing down oil, and they're going to be putting it on ships, and they're going to be exporting it to whoever will buy it. So the volumes that we saw on the Hudson are not necessarily the final volumes, okay? Mm-hmm. And everyone understands, if you look at the spill records in places like Galveston and the Houston Ship Channel, everyone understands that volume and vessels and volume moved equals increased fills. That's just the way it is. We all understand it. The records are there. I'm not inventing it. So the problem we have with crude oil is, you're right, it needs to go to refineries. There are other routes to refineries. There is waiting for pipelines that are under construction to be built from Dakota to the to refineries. But the industry doesn't want to wait. The industry is moving it in the DOT 111 cars, which are not being refitted in spite of the fact that they blow up. And industry is moving it down the Hudson. And, you know, if we ask industry to slow down, don't bring it out of the ground so fast. Let's take the time to build a refinery in North Dakota. No, no way. No way. No way. So you're right that we all use gas. But that doesn't mean, as an automatic on-off switch, that it has to come down the Hudson. 25% of the crude oil produced in North Dakota is coming down the Hudson Valley. And your community isn't making a dime. Okay, so response is very important. Why is crude oil a risk? And this is where we disagree. I've been working for years now with EPA, DEC, NOAA, and the Coast Guard. We've worked, you know, collaboratively, not at odds. There has been a good faith effort by the Coast Guard and the DEC to increase the response capability on Hudson. We've worked with, I've had the head spills from the DEC ride with me 3 days down the river, showed him every mouth of every marsh. Along with him came the Coast Guard guy who was in charge of creating the 500-page area contingency plan, which is the response Bible. And for the first time now, they have a zoomed-in little GIS maps that show every marsh, how much boom it would take to protect every marsh. It's a huge improvement. We just had a tug hit the Tappan-Zee Bridge earlier this year. You guys heard about it in the news. It wasn't an oil barge. The tug had oil in the hull. So I'm acknowledging that Coast Guard DC had done a great job. The problem is, when that tug hit the bridge, the fuel came out of the tanks of the vessel. And you're 25 nautical miles from the battery at that point. You're right close to New York Harbor, where it's one of the largest oil spill response capabilities in North America. They did a grand thing that until that year they said they could never do, which was they could not protect Piermont Marsh, which is 1,000 acres of brackish marsh. They could never stretch boom over the whole mouth, face of Piermont Marsh. And I challenged them. I said, you guys, we can do this. Figure it out. Do a drill. And when that tug hit, they did it. They stretched 14,000 feet of boom. But they did it 36 hours later. So, part one, they did the impossible. Part two, they did it too late. If it had been blowing that day, and it had been a big accident, like, the allegation is that accidents don't happen. Here's a spill in the Mississippi River in 2014, a Bakken oil spill, double hull barge, 36,000 gallons spilled. It's minor. 90 gallons recovered. 90 gallons was recovered. So the point that I want to make is that an accident on the Hudson means, and all the officials will agree, yes, no oil is going to be recovered. They'll respond. There'll be an army-like rollout, but there won't be recovery. And that's really what's driving the situation. The stuff mixes with the water column, it catches the particles, it sinks in the river at next to Lac Megantic, where that accident happened in Canada. 50% reduction in biodiversity a couple years later. And a lot of fish that work the bottom and feed on the bottom have lesions. So we have a product that's moving in the Hudson that's very dangerous, and that's what's driving this great concern.
Okay, thank you, John. What I'm going to do is we're going to give Edward a minute. He had a question for you, and then I'm going to open it up to the folks in here. But it's only going to be 10 minutes, so just like a minute, a person, just ask your question, and then we have 90 seconds.
Day-night operations, yes, there is no restriction on day or night operations. I don't know who said they can't or won't operate in day or night. If somebody's unsafe, they can do that. You obviously have clear evidence that people do routinely safely operate at night. I don't think I don't see the point that is. The Tappan Zee, as you probably know, also a 4-foot operation that was uniquely involved in the construction operation at the Tappan Zee. This was not transporting cargo. This was positioning a construction crane at the Tappan Zee. The only way that could happen again, if somebody decides to repair a bridge or a tunnel or build a new bridge. That's not transportation on the Hudson River. That's a construction project. That was a separate thing. The sturgeon, once again, yes, no one can tell us that it's good or bad. And if there does come out science someplace that specifically says that this is detrimental to sturgeon, I'm sure we'll have to move that anchorage. On the other hand, they may come out and say that the scarring of the bottom is what's creating good nesting areas, in which case then they're going to ask us to scar the whole river for them. I don't want to get involved in a philosophical discussion regarding fossil fuels in the United States or the rest of the world. We will all go on wind energy. Obviously, everyone will go home tonight and turn their car off and throw their key into the bushes. You know, none of us will need electricity. That's not my business. That's not my problem. As citizens, everybody's entitled to their voice. If you are against the United States creating oil or using oil products, because Bakken oil is certainly something that's a relatively new commodity moving southbound, and that's replaced a lot of the oil, some of it that moved northbound. Oil in the system is oil in the system. There will be oil moving on the Hudson River. My only concern in this topic is strictly and exclusively involved in if there will be products moving on the Hudson River, should there be opportunities for mariners to do it safely. This is not about whether or not you support fracking. This is not about whether or not you think that your oil is going to magically appear or be transported and not get to you. I don't know how it's going to move if it's not moved by barge, by truck, or by rail. If they build a pipeline, it'll stop moving. Approach your legislators. Talk to your government. Have them build a pipeline. I don't care. But as long as there will be products moving in the Hudson River, even if it is aggregate, rocks, or anything else, we need a way to safely operate. These anchorages provide opportunities for emergency bailouts, reduced visibility. You say you usually don't see six, now there's 30. There's an opportunity right now to do any of them. 30 are available. It doesn't mean they're all going to be used. It doesn't mean there's some big uptick in business here. We are looking for a place to safely stop transits when they are at risk. When these mariners feel that their cargo, their lives, or the river is imperiled, they need a spot to stop these vessels and to anchor them until they are clear and safe to move again. That's what this issue is about. This is not whether or not you believe in the use of fossil fuels, or you want to build a wind farm in your backyard, or if you want to further research on whether scarred bottoms are good or bad for sturgeon, because the scientists don't know that yet. They're all valid issues. They should all be discussed. Not my problem. Not what this is about. This is about when people are in danger, they need a safe refuge. If they don't have a safe refuge, they will operate in dangerous conditions, and you will see accidents that will result in spills in the river. Nobody wants that, least of all our industry.
Okay, John, quick, and then what are we going to do? Lessa, and then will you two?
Nobody wants to operate dangerously. Nobody. If any vessel that's in distress for any reason, whether it's weather or equipment or personnel, can request an anchorage right now, and they get it. So, again, we're saying safety first. But authorize anchorages with all the potential problems they bring, because we're not getting the full story. No. Temporary as-need anchorage authorized by the Coast Guard, as in Sandy, yes.
Okay. Do you mind, John and I, we're taking a couple questions from people.
So, no, I'm not.
Okay.
Sure.
My name is Wayne Kosher. I worked in the fuel industry. I retired from Metro North Railroad. I got to tell you, there was a lot of spills. There was a lot of spills that weren't reported. Mm-hmm. This need for oil, I'm less is more. I come here with another person. I drive a Prius. If the lights are left on in my house, you have to pay 25 cents if you're not in the room. We don't need energy if we don't use it.
I agree.
Okay, now, if anybody wants to go fishing tomorrow, we go buy a fishing license. If you read the book, it says women and children of childbearing age eat nothing from this river. We don't need any more chances of a spill.
Here. But that's not what this is about.
Well, you're talking about more ships coming up here.
But we can't stop more ships.
What do you mean you can't stop them? What did we do until now?
This is parking ships.
Look at our cancer rate. In 1950, one out of 30.
If 1,000 ships leave the city tomorrow to go to Albany, can we stop them? Does this legislation stop them?
The capacity of the Port of Albany is what's restricting. And so the reason for reduced, see, it's part of a bigger picture. The Port of Albany is slated to be increased in size. The Port of Cleveland is supposed to be increased in size. A rail spur was built from Selkirk, is being funded by the state down from Selkirk to the Port of Cleveland. An oil terminal was proposed for Newburgh. When we talk about reindustrialization of the valley, anchorages are part of a larger picture. If another terminal is built in Albany, more vessels are going to be needed. And the specter, I know it was dismissed, the specter of storage of oil while prices are down is not imaginary. I can leave you with two articles where it's being done now.
Okay, all right, let's go.
In major you're first, you're second.
Absolutely,
it's being done.
Just ask a question, though. No comments, just questions. This is not a question. We'll end it up. We burn oil, and therefore we need this. This is part of a plan to vastly increase the amount of oil on the river.
And I actually do run my car on vegetable oil, and
I know that.
Whether you like it or not, solar has reached beyond the tipping point to where it's taking off. And the oil is on the downslope. So anything that increases the amount of oil at this point in time is counterproductive. We can, just don't need it, and it's an increasing hazard. And the industry is not going to be, it's not like pipeline or rail or barge. They want all of it, and as much as possible, as quickly as possible, to export it. At a minimum, we need to demand that there are full hearings on this that go beyond, I believe it's just October, you know, because this is, has nothing to do with safety. As the gentleman from Riverkeeper pointed out very eloquently, if it's a safety issue, they can still pull over. Not a problem. This is establishing a huge increase in traffic, and it's mostly oil traffic. It needs to be vetted very, very thoroughly.
Okay. Thank you.
Counting up the parking spaces here in the anchorages from the Coast Guard.
You're next.
Coast Guard after him. Rule document. There are 43 of them. I'm thinking about the Calm Hook and the Diamond Reef accidents. In Diamond Reef, there was like 160,000 gallons of kerosene. Yeah. Kerosene evaporates. It goes up into the atmosphere and is dispersed. My question is, with an increase in traffic, that would likely happen with the increase in these ports, and what would be the resultant increase in chance of an accident compared to kerosene? What would be the effect of a Bakken crude spill in the Hudson River?
Kerosene flashes off, gasoline flashes off. They don't even try to contain gasoline or ethanol. The risk is explosion with ethanol and gas. Kerosene is mixed. Bakken is a crude oil. It's mutagenic. The fumes are mutagenic and carcinogenic. Once spilled, it cannot be recovered. It cannot be recovered. And so the other specter that we're facing is that the global facility in Albany has asked for permits to build a rail car heating facility. They want that for one reason only. They want to be able to bring in bitumen tar sands from Alberta, which can't be pumped. It's solid. You pick up chunks of it. And if you can heat it, then you can pump it in the barges. The barges have heating elements in them. And now we're facing a potential transport on the Hudson of an oil that is dense enough to sink. No recovery is possible of either Bakken or
okay, Mr. Ford, you got a question, and then you'll be next, okay?
I'm Bill Ford. I'm old enough to know
we're done in 3 minutes.
Dayliners used to come up and discharge people to the park at Kingston Point, and it was a tremendous tourist attraction for dozens of years. I also know that Thomas Cornell and Mr. Kirkendall reported that there were 600,000 tourists that came up the Hudson River to be able to go up and visit and establish towns and everything in the Catskill. So the river is tremendously important as a tourist attraction. Kingston is one of the most historic cities in the state. And from what I can read on this, you're going to destroy Kingston Point. Looks like it. You're going to take up every single spot that people go down there and sit on the beach and look at the river. And if that's a safety issue, I'm ready to fight it. And as of tomorrow, I will start circulating these petitions. And you said in your letter that I read in the paper that only a few people are objecting to this. You're going to see thousands. Point take it back. On my word.
I think I was taking a look at that.
I have a question, which is, what percentage of the oil and crude that's coming into Albany and going up and down the river ultimately is for export now?
None for export yet that I'm aware of, because the price is so low that there's no market. The oil, like gasoline and diesel fuel and heating oil, that go north, that is a constant, relatively constant flow, because the number of people living north are the same. They still heat. They still run cars. So that flow of refined product north, the traditional transport of petroleum, has relatively not changed. The increase in transport, starting in 2012, that led to the boats, the vessels anchoring at Port Ewing, is in crude oil transport. The Port of Albany wasn't set up for it, and so that's where we're getting at this congestion.
But where is that going?
That's going to Linden, until the export ban was lifted, it was going to Linden, New Jersey, and Philly. And a ship every 8 days was going from Albany to New Brunswick, the Aphrodite. She had a loophole. If you sell oil to New Brunswick, there was a loophole in the export ban that said if the petroleum refined products sold back to the United States, you can export.
That's all it was moving today.
As soon as the price goes up,
they're catching up with the removal of the ban.
Right. Now when the ban is lifted, we're going to see potential increases.
Okay, one more question, Mary.
Okay.
And then we're going to stay for a couple legislators.
Hi, Mr. Kelly. My name is Miriam Strauss. I noticed you did mention about birth, which would fit in as one of the reasons, apart from the existing safety uses. And Mr. Liscombe spoke about basically you are going to have ships queuing up to get available dock space for the Bakken crude to come out of Albany. The tie-in that I would like the legislators to talk about, particularly in light of the two laterals for the proposed Pilgrim pipelines, is one of those laterals is in southern Ulster County. The other one is in northern Orange County. And if you look at the map, there are a lot of berths off the areas surrounding those two laterals. So my take, based on what you were saying about the export market, is that when that export market appears, they'll be there ready and waiting. The other thing I want to say, attaboy to you, sir, and we've been circulating a petition and I've got some signed copies here, but if folks want to see it, they can, but it's really for the Coast Guard. So that may be wrong designation.
Okay.
And people's concern, our communities have invested too much in the revitalization of the river is the key point.
Okay.
Because we have.
Thanks, ma'am. Okay, Legislator Heppner, then Legislator Bartels.
I wanted to thank Mr. Kelly for coming all the way out here to Ulster County. And hopefully you obviously have made it clear that you join a lot of the public in hoping and being open to more hearings and more public hearings rather than an online docket. There's a quick question specific to the need for these anchorages. I totally understand the importance of safety for the crews, and I think all sides agree with that. My one question is, would there be a scenario where there's too much cargo coming into the Port of Albany to where ships would anchor just for the purpose of the queue in and out of the port? So not for emergency, not for weather, but just simply because of the queue at the port in Albany. Would that be a situation where a ship would anchor in the Kingston hub for simply the purpose of waiting it out to get in and out while other ships are getting in and out?
Could it happen? Yes. Will it happen? Probably not very often. Why? Because it costs money. To position empty equipment up there is a relatively short amount of time. Even if we're moving it from the port in New York, repositioning it up empty, it's a matter of a day's transit, barring any unknown. If we know there's a problem in Albany, why would anybody dispatch something to be sitting there paying crew, paying for barges, paying for fuel, mm-hmm. for no reason? Okay. So could it happen? Could there be a delay in somebody vacating a berth? Could it there be a high demand berth? Yeah, that can happen. Is it a routine thing? Does it make economic sense to pre-position empty stuff up there and then have it sit there? No.
Okay.
So the people generally don't do what doesn't make economic sense. Follow the money and you'll have your answer.
Okay. But the reality is that all the vessels that stopped at Port Elon were empties waiting to go north. No southbounds ever anchored. That answers your question. No southbounds ever anchor. The big bulk carriers that anchor at Hyde Park are waiting for their berth to open in Albany. Now, they may be waiting on the tide. They may be waiting on another ship to leave, but they're waiting on a berth in Albany. All the vessels that brought the ire of the community in Rhinecliffe and Port Hudson were empty crude oil barges waiting to go north, not full diesel or heating oil or gasoline barges.
Okay,
that's a fact. Answer your question.
I just wanted to get clarification from John. He said we'd heard that that the anchorage is that the ships stay for 12 hours, but then you had said many days.
Well, you've got numerous people that live in Port Ewan and Hyde Park that can attest, not just me, to vessels staying for multiple days.
In non-regulated anchorages, that's why the federal anchorages offer Coast Guard the ability to regulate those anchorages. Right now, there is no regulation. People do what they want.
But
if
so
they're
wait,
regulated,
just to
then
clarify,
they're regulated.
If, okay. If it's a non-regulated anchorage, you're saying that it's the Wild West. They could just stay forever? Isn't it that the fact that because it wasn't regulated and there were complaints, they were pointed out that they're in a non-regulated anchorage and they couldn't stay there? I mean, isn't that what began according to
the best way to control anchorage vessels is to regulate them.
But what are you saying? If it's not regulated, there's no control, no one has any say, they could just stay wherever forever?
If there were no laws on the parkways, you could drive any speed you want.
Well, I'm not talking about the parkways.
No, but I'm just saying, it's non-regulated. It's
non-regulated. I get what you're saying. He's being pretty clear. Right now, there's
non-regulated.
No. It's non-regulated. They get stuck for 2 years.
Can just stay there forever?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right now. Right now.
Port Ewan, they can't stay at all anymore. They might have to the Coast Guard to vacate. Port Ewan is closed.
But prior to that, there was.
Prior to that, they were there for days. And the assumption has been made that the Coast Guard monitored the anchorages. There's a Coast Guard base in Sorgerties, 10 miles from Kingston.
Right.
The Coast Guard buoy tenders go up and down the river all the time. So the Coast Guard saw these vessels anchored at a non-authorized anchorage and nothing happened. So the idea that the Coast Guard is going to closely monitor the anchorages is also. Not that they wouldn't do it if they had the funding, but everybody is under staff. But so monitoring of anchorages and monitoring of vessels that anchor is just not happening.
Okay.
Excuse me.
I just want to go on record that I believe the Coast Guard does their job. I am not going to have it stated on this record that the Coast Guard is not going to enforce their own regulations. That's bizarre.
If anybody's here for the Laws and Rules Committee, they have canceled it. This meeting's just going to run long. We've got a ways to go. So Dave just told me that meeting is canceled. If you're here for Laws and Rules, it was supposed to follow this meeting. You're welcome to stay because this meeting's going to be very interesting. But Laws and Rules has been canceled. It's a special meeting.
Okay. All right. We're going to...
Thank you both.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Kelly.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Solicito. I appreciate all your comments.
You have my card.
Your expertise is...
If you send me just an email,
yeah,
I'd have your contact info. Any question or anything else, if there's any other reason to come up here.
Helpful.
It's a rather pleasant two-hour drive. No, it really was, you know.
Yeah,
I brought my wife. I have excellent company, so I don't mind coming back at any time.
I'm from New Jersey.
Well, get home safe.
You know, I was... Yeah, I don't know. New Jersey gets maligned.
I know,
the good news is most people only know about the nasty part of the turnpike, and they don't know how nice the rest of the state is.
Okay, we're going to put... Jordan, thank you. Thank you. We'll be in touch with you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Get home safe.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, it should be nice. Yeah,
yeah, still.
Yeah, it's not bad.
Oh, yeah.
Thanks a lot. I
Okay, yep, this is for the record.
You have to remember what happened.
And Jennifer Peck, I went to Mondale with them. And their dad was my little league.
So we go to the store.
Can I keep one cup? I have one cup.
Actually, we have to do this one. Change it a little.
All right, we're going to do the plastic bag legislation. Tom, thank you for coming. And Jordan
Fisher, thank you guys for coming. And I know I've been speaking to Tracy. I'll let her take it.
Yeah, so I, Tom, I had forwarded to Fawn, but something happened with the email, the fact sheet that you sent. So we don't have it. But I think what we really wanted to do today is just start the discussion, at least, rather than bring forward legislation that then we begin in a debate mode. I wanted to kind of get consensus at the table. And Hector and I attended a forum that Tom held in Marbletown. And prior to that,
it was in Cape Cod.
Prior to that, I was sent, and Hector came because I couldn't speak. I had to be terrible.
Yeah.
Prior to that, I attended the EMC retreat with Mary that Dave Haldeman was here, held at Omega.
Of course, Institute. River.
Yeah, and the plastic bag issue came up there as well. So that's where it first piqued my interest, that this might be really a time for us to be talking about it. Jordan is an expert in plastic bag legislation, so I think it would be just helpful for all of us to hear what other communities are doing. And Tom will be able to speak to it, but I just want to begin sort of lay the overarching idea that one of the reasons I think it's important for us, and this is what came up at the EMC, to start having the discussion at the county level. We know that we have communities, the Village of New Paltz, in the county that have it, but and Tom will be able to speak to this. There's a concern, and we heard it at the EMC meeting, about if the county's going to move forward, whether or not individual communities should move forward, and the reverse of that, if it shouldn't be the county moving forward for a unified, for sort of a unified front, and also to protect against the perception that individual businesses might have that they'd be setting themselves up against neighboring communities.
Right, right. No, I understand what you're saying.
So I'm going to turn it over right now to Tom and Jordan, and we. I would like us to be
informational and questions.
It's all good. Thank you.
Jordan, why don't you go first and just talk about what's happening all around the country?
Sure. So I'll do a quick overview. First off, just the issue. I probably don't have to go very in-depth of why we should not be using single-use plastic in paper bags, but the goal of all of the legislation across the country is not to switch plastic for paper or vice versa. It's to get people to switch permanently to reusable bags. So in the U.S., we use 100 billion plastic bags a year. It takes 2.2 billion pounds of fossil fuels to make them and ship them. Then they end up as litter in our parks. It rains, they get washed into our storm drains where they cause localized flooding, end up in the ocean where they remain forever, maybe 100, we don't know how long it takes because we haven't had them that long. It's only been about 50 years since we've had these single-use plastic bags, but the estimation is minimum hundreds of years. They negatively impact 267 species, marine and avian. It's bad for, you know, the Hudson River, it's bad for tourism, it's bad for, you know, restaurants along the shore. And U.S. retailers spend $4 billion a year just to buy these bags. So we've been getting them for free forever. But a plastic bag costs between 1 and 2 cents for every bag. Paper bags, 5 or 10 cents every time. So that's money that the retailers are spending, and we've just been getting them for free, so we think that they're throwaway. But they're actually a pretty valuable commodity because they're made out of fossil fuels or made out of paper. So across the country, there's a couple different forms of legislation that have been popping up to incentivize reuse bag use. The first one that we've seen a lot in New York, Westport, Connecticut was the first town east of Mississippi to do it. It's just straight banning plastic bags. So it's what New Paltz has. It's what a lot of the villages in Westchester and Long Island have out east. And it works really well for smaller communities because they can do a lot of education, especially in places where there aren't big grocery stores, but it's a lot of mom-and-pop places. You can see pretty significant reductions in plastic bags. The only issue is there's some loopholes in them. So we've seen this in some communities where they don't have a really strong educational component. Some stores are switching to slightly thicker bags. So it's a ban across the board. They're 2.25 mil. It's basically the thin bags you get at any grocery store. Sort of what's been happening is that some of the grocers are buying slightly thicker bags, like 3 or 4 mil, and just giving them out for free. Or people are switching to paper bags, which we definitely don't want to see. From a, you know, water usage, fossil fuel, carbon emission perspective, paper is actually worse than plastic. So we want to make sure that you're not giving people an easy out where they're going to the grocery store and just saying, all right, no problem, just get this slightly thicker reusable bag or a paper bag. So the legislation that for CCE we most prefer is a ban on those single-use thin plastic bags, accompanied with a fee on the paper bags and the thicker plastic bags. So Newcastle in Westchester was the first New York municipality to pass this, but most of California has it. It's going to likely go into effect. They have a ballot initiative this November. And what we've seen are huge bag reduction numbers. In L.A. County, they have a 10-cent fee accompanied with the ban. They have a 94% reduction in all disposable bag use. So not only the 100% reduction in the thin plastic, but they also saw a 25% reduction in paper because people really got into the habit of bringing their own. And those numbers are pretty across the board for California. And then the last type of legislation that we've seen a lot recently popping up are fees. So Washington, D.C. has had a 5-cent fee for the last 6 years. New York City just passed a 5-cent fee. And these we also support. We believe Suffolk County is going to pass a 5-cent fee on September 7th. They just don't hit quite the reduction numbers, but, you know, if you can get most of the problem under wraps, you want to do it. So,
baby steps, too, sometimes.
Exactly, yeah. So for the fee, between 60 and 90% reduction for like a 5 or 10 cent fee. D.C. is like 60%. We just saw in England they have a 5 pence charge, which is, I guess, 6 or 7 cents. They just reported an 85% reduction for their first 10 months. So I guess it varies in terms of education and how successful you are. But, I mean, minimum 50% reduction. We've never seen less with a well-implemented fee compared to the 90-some-odd percent for a ban. So it's sort of up to you guys. We support both. Obviously, we prefer a ban because it gets at slightly more of the problem. And the other thing is with the ban, we find that it's a little bit more largely supported by the public. I think the public likes the idea of the across-the-board, just get rid of the bags thing. I think the fee gets a little bit more confusing. You have to explain, oh, no, it's not a tax. It's just a fee. It goes back to the retailer. We can't use it for parks or else we need state enabling legislation. It's just a heftier issue. However, grocers tend to like the fee because then they could still
sure.
have the bags. So we're sort of playing it by ear, county by county. Westchester County, Erie, Dutchess, a couple other ones are considering moving forward also.
Okay.
So Marbletown started looking into this about 2 years ago when we after we saw New Paltz had passed there, mm-hmm. the village had passed their ban. We did some polling of our retailers and our shoppers and had pretty strong support from both. There were, you know, a majority of both were in favor of a plastic bag ban. However, at the same time, in parallel, we were researching bag laws and came to the same conclusion Jordan just told you, that a fee might actually be better and have a better for the environment. We didn't expect any problem from retailers from a fee because they get to keep the money, but to our surprise, our retailer didn't like the fee.
Wow.
And so that was November. I then held this workshop where we all got together, brought Jordan in the hopes of, well, let's figure it out. I mean, we all want a ban, let's just, you know, retailers, I apparently annoyed the retailers and they didn't show up. They also are busy. So right now we are, I'm going to be proposing at the next board meeting that the town board pass a plastic bag ban, which I actually had support for, but got sidetracked, and a resolution asking Ulster County to pass a ban plus 10-cent fee, which is what we concluded at the workshop was probably the best legislation. Don't know where we'll get with that, but that's where the town currently is. After that, if I'm successful at that, I'm going to be going to the other towns and trying to get them to pass the same resolution part, because I hope that will help you.
That's a quick question. Just because this happened, you guys might be aware of it. In New York State, if municipalities want to implement a tax, such as a hotel tax, we have to go to the state with a home rule request for that. There was just a new precedent set in the state legislature where you had the Senate interpret New York City's fee as a tax and therefore assert that they had the authority to say, no, you can't do this. What are your thoughts on that? What do you guys see? I'm sure the other side has looked into the legal precedent as well, just because this is how things work in New York State. So I was just curious if you had any thought on that.
I have a lot of thoughts on it because I'm intimately involved with the New York City audit. I was at all the Senate preemption hearings. So one of the issues that I will say right out is that this is primarily an issue between New York City and Albany. This is an internal politics issue. However, the language of the bill that they want to go pass last year is extremely broad and problematic. So they wrote it basically just to say New York City can't implement their law. And I know they specifically meant it for just cities, just implementing fees. However, it's worded in kind of a broad way, so it might apply to all plastic bag legislation in all municipalities. From what I've heard, we would imagine that based on a lot of assembly resistance and some Senate resistance from areas where they already have bag legislation or they're considering it, they might be redrafting this bill in January so that it's much more specific to the city, so it wouldn't affect you guys. That's what I would imagine would happen, because they certainly don't want, like, the head of the Senate is in Suffolk County, which is about to pass a fee. I don't think that they're going to want to have to deal with the home rule issue. But certainly, right now, it has to go to the retailer, the charge. You can't use it. It's interpreted as a fee. So you need state enabling legislation if you wanted to use it for parks or upgrading recycling or some of the other places people have been using it. So that's also why the fee, like the Food Industry Alliance, which is the alliance of all the grocers, was actually suing Hastings on Hudson over their bag ban, but is supportive of the fee in New York City and Suffolk because it goes back to the retailers and it just covers their initial cost. And they don't particularly like bans, but they're definitely more partial to a ban with a fee attached. Paper is far more expensive, so I think the last thing they want is, instead of spending a penny and a half on a plastic bag, they're spending 10 cents on a paper bag. Mm. So as long as there's a fee attached, it tends to be a little smoother.
But I can balance out. Yeah.
Can I just say, I support a ban. I personally, I think it should be a statewide or countywide one. And I spoke to our grocer here in Marbletown, Emmanuel, a couple weeks ago, who I'm very good friends with. And he's very supportive of a countywide ban. He said he'd stand up at a public hearing, and I'm not putting words in his mouth, he said I wholeheartedly support it. He feels if it's a town of Marbletown ban, he would be adversely affected. He said, I feel if it's a town ban, you know, the smaller town grocery stores don't have the pricing ability to compete as well as the big chain stores. And I think if he had to charge for bags...
Okay, so he told you that about a ban as well as a fee? Because every time I try to talk to him, he's in surgery. It's... I'm sorry.
Yeah. No, yeah. But yeah, he said, you know, I didn't talk to him about all the different options. I mean,
right.
He said, listen, if you're going to ban plastic bags, mm-hmm. I'm all for it. If you're not going to ban... In the county.
In county.
Okay. I do it voluntarily if everybody did it. I don't need a law. But I think he's just worried if the bags get banned, then he would, you know, maybe the nickel bag. I'm just saying. So I think that's just my opinion. Is okay. I think a countywide one would put all the retailers at a level playing field, and I'm not opposed to a 5 cent bag charge or something, but I don't think we should just take everything out of the stores at once. Because I just, you know, I try to use a reusable bag, but there's times I'm coming home from work and my wife's like, hey, so-and-so's coming over, can you get some chopped meat, this and this, and I don't have bags in my car. So, you know, you just have to...
I always buy a new one, and now I have like...
Yeah. So, and finally...
They also have piles of boxes, they don't provide bags.
Just my last thought on it is, I mean, I think that we should, if we do move forward with it, is partner with the RRA and let's make 50,000 bags
of
the reusable bags, and let's give them out for free to the residents. Let's make, you know, they're saving millions on net service fee. So let's make 100, 200, you know, whatever that is.
An educational
component. You put the education things right in the bags, you give them to the retailers and you know, so.
Yeah, I wanted to say that, you know, this is something we took up a long time ago, and my recall from that period was that the problematic aspect of what we were proposing was the fee, because there was a big discussion about, is it a tax, is it a fee? But as I've been educated in this process and read the documentation that Jordan's shared and talked to Jordan about it, the idea of the combination... To me, it's protective of the retailers, because exactly for the reason you're saying, if the plastic bags are banned, but you're still allowed to have paper, you don't want to encourage paper use. So if you forget something, you can have a paper bag. You just have to charge for it, but the charge covers your cost. So we're not punishing the retailers for our law or requiring that they spend money unduly and take a loss. But and we're allowing them to still provide a service to their customers, but at the same time, we're really encouraging customers through having the fee to think about remembering those plastic bags. And I'm certainly guilty as well. I mean, it happens where I always have the bags in my car, always, but sometimes I walk in and I've forgotten them, and now I have a bunch of stuff and a five-year-old, and I think, oh my God, I'm going to walk all the way back out and leave everything melting. And so sometimes I take the bags too. But through a repetition of having to pay 10 cents each one. I mean, I frankly, when I heard the numbers from Jordan and researched them myself, and I've just been sent more information about the numbers, I think it's so heartening, if not shocking, that the success is so high, 94% for a 10 cent fee. You know, you'd think it wouldn't achieve such high success rates, but it's encouraging to me, and I agree with you that I think
we need to be thinking about it at a county level, because I think it won't be just one retailer in your community who has that feeling. It's going to be in communities all around. And at the EMC meeting, multiple communities, we know Woodstock's been interested for a long time, has talked about it going way back, but multiple, if it pushed came to shove, in each community there would be retailers who would feel that they were at a disadvantage against their immediate neighbor.
Right. Hector, let me let Jonathan, he's on the committee.
I just for my own education, because I've talked to folks, and I represent Woodstock, and we have a lot of self-regulated businesses that are great, that are really environmentally conscious, whether it goes to styrofoam, to bags, whatever. But the people I have heard concerns about, like, for example, we have multiple hardware stores. So, like, they, you know, package things differently than, say, a grocery store. So but they're still technically a retailer. So, like, is the hardware store that's, you know, they use bags,
put nails in,
you know, there's different ways they package things for different needs. Like, is there, like, how do you address those? Just because, how do I go to that business owner and, you know, say how it will affect them?
No, yeah, definitely. And I think a lot of it is also town by town, county by county, depending on what comes up. So, like, for example, a lot of the legislation is only at retailers where their primary business is food, so grocery stores, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Like, for Suffolk County and for the village of Patchogue, specifically in Suffolk, they're addressing everything. So it's like, you know, convenience stores, delis, all those things are covered, apparel stores. And for those ones, they made specific exemptions. So, like, for example, in the village of Patchogue, they have, like, a fish market, mm-hmm. and you obviously don't want to just be putting fish and newspaper in a plastic bag. So it's a specific exemption for them. Mm-hmm. Some based on, like, local laws have exempted liquor because you need some sort of, you know, you can't just carry beer or liquor out. Depending on what comes up from the retailers and what the chamber says, you can certainly write in specific exemptions, because I really don't think it's the fish market that's creating the problem, and you would certainly want to wrap those. Same way, almost all of them actually exempt, like, produce bags. You can put your meat or your vegetables in a separate bag, dry cleaning bags. So the businesses that need it and you think it's a rational exemption, you can sort of...
That's a good point. That six-pack rule, like, it's the craziest.
And actually, the produce bags, I would liken the nail bags to the produce bags. When you're shopping in the aisle, you put your lettuce into a bag that then goes into the bag that's regulated. But I think we'd have to spell it out.
Well, no, all the legislation I've seen specifies bags provided at checkout. So that's the difference between the nail bags and the produce bags.
Yeah, right there.
Right.
That's a good point.
So you can phrase it in the produce bag exemption and for hardware, whatever they call those bags.
Well, first off, I think I want to live in Jordan's world where we've got the fish wrapped up in newspaper, or we're all walking around with booze in our hands. I was also going to make the joke that if we end up passing a fee, we have to call it the Gary Bischoff Law, but that's different. The point that I really just want to just hit home on is that, you know, I happen to live in the village of New Paltz, which, of course, you know, passed a ban. But, you know, one of the things that sort of, it was a great, and I still support it and still think it's great. However, most of our commercial activity happens out in the town. And, you know, it's basically an artificial boundary that creates a village of New Paltz, right? Basically, literally right by where the middle school is. And all of your grocery stores are all in the town.
Really? That's the village?
That's literally the
South
village.
South Park Corner is not the village? No.
Nope. Nope, all that's the town. And so that's part of where, you know, so that's where it's sort of like, yeah, it's great that we did that, but in a weird way, we sort of created this sort of artificial...
Right, you're not hitting that.
We actually put some of our retailers actually in the village at a disadvantage by comparison, which are already at a disadvantage.
Right.
So Jack's, for example, now, they're not really competing per se with Stop and Shop. I mean, they're different models. But it's still, it's sort of a kind of a bitch of our local you know, retailers, and so that's where I really just think that we have to do this at the county level. I think it really is incumbent on us, and I think if we decide to do this, that we need to move as quickly as possible.
Listen, we can work on it. I mean, I don't think whether it's 2 weeks or 2 months, I don't think it's the end of the world. I think it's got to be well written. It's going to have support of the legislature. It's going to have support of the executive.
Sure.
And I don't think, certainly there's laws out there we can model it after.
Yeah. With the public, I've only heard positive.
Yeah.
Everybody I've talked to, they said, oh, yeah, you should do that.
Yeah, I don't think it's finished.
I haven't heard anybody really. And I think the fee leaves a level playing field.
Yeah.
What?
teaming up and supplying the bags of things.
Yeah,
it's the key.
One other thing I think you should, a lot of people have mentioned, you know, the often bring up the incentives people, some stores give to retailers, give to shoppers to bring a reusable, which is a great idea, but there is research out there showing that it's very ineffective at actually changing behavior.
The what now?
Most have dropped them.
Like ShopRite and New Pulse, they give you 5 cents for every bag you bring yourself.
And
although your bag holds 5 of theirs.
Yeah. But so it's just in this conversation, it's sort of good to know that up front.
Right. Yeah, I wouldn't see any reason for them to pay you to bring something.
Well, they can. I mean, there's certainly no reason not to.
But it's like Price Chopper does.
But it's not something that's worth us considering in legislation.
Right. And then just one more thing I'd like to add sort of on that note to nip it, because I'm sure it's going to become an issue. One of the things that the plastic bag manufacturers and the grocers will always push for is that they say, oh, we should be doing recycling like we do for, like, the bottle bill and things like that. But just so you know, the recycling rates for plastic bags are abysmal. 5 cents.
Yeah.
5%, 10%.
Yeah.
Yeah, and in New York...
And those bags break, and you need 4 of them to...
Exactly.
To make up for one.
Yeah.
I regret it.
And
like styrofoam, the amount of product that you need to make it economical... That's where the ineffectiveness comes. I mean, with styrofoam, I talked when this whole issue came up about recycling styrofoam. I talked to the pilot program and we ran the numbers. They said, "Oh, it's doing great." And we ran the numbers and they determined that it was going to take 80 months to get a tractor trailer load. And they were feeling it was successful, but it has to be compacted. And then, so where are you going to store it for 80 months?
You know, we're not supporting ourselves for not moving it out.
Right.
That's how we, that's our revenue to...
Yeah, the recycling, I think, yeah.
Yeah, and the municipal recyclers pretty much everywhere have come out, like, in favor of legislation, whether it's a bureau bank who's just, like, styrofoam, it gets caught in the equipment, it's man hours, it's very annoying, there's really no product, like a plastic bag, you don't recycle it into a plastic bag, you recycle it into, like, a drug
product. If I go to Dunkin' Donuts, I like the new cups better than the old styrofoam cups.
Yeah.
I think they're just... They're nicer to hold, they're clean. I don't know. I think it's...
Yeah, and that's, you know, you reminded me, and I think all of us, with the exception of Jonathan, probably have been on, including Fawn at the table, have been on these tours of the various facilities over the couple of years that we've been working on solid waste management issue. And in all those facilities, bar none, the sticking point is the plastic bags. Mm-hmm. In the waste to compost, the plastic bags were kind of summing up the works.
That was all that was caught up in it. Yep.
And then in the landfills, it's worse than the vectors, the flying plastic bags. So plastic bags, I think we all recognize the problem. And that's why to know with such certainty that we can achieve such success. And I hadn't thought about the idea of, I don't know what they cost to make, but to spend some money making those bags, that's a...
I did them when I was a realtor. And I still see people with
the ordering right now. It's $1 a bag.
I'm
sure the more you order, the cheaper they are.
They weren't even $1 a bag. They imprinted
it. So two quick ideas for the bags, since it's the best idea. One is to have, like, a local student competition for the art for it. Mm-hmm. And the other is to get it where you get a bunch of local businesses who are supportive, like grocery stores, whatever, to all go in together so they can put their logos on the back of the bag or something so that the county doesn't have to pay for it themselves.
I know what you're saying, but I think about
it. It's an option.
I think we've done enough with, saving money and with the RRA that we could
So then make a good county.
They're always being hit up for everything. They're getting hit up for Little League. They're getting hit up for this, for Boy Scouts, for Girl Scouts.
But the reusable giveaway without some other legislation might be worse than...
I'm talking about in addition to saying, hey, you're not going to get plastic bags. You might get charged a nickel or dime for your paper bag. So here, we're going to hand out these bags. That's what I was getting at.
The EPC did that before. The town of New Paltz, lots of towns have done this all over. I've got like 7 different bags. The town of New Paltz.
So what I'd like to do is... get the model legislation from Jordan, and before I come back with it, submitting it as legislation, can we have one more time where we discuss it as legislation, and then we'll decide.
Yeah, why don't we have a sample one next?
That's what I mean. Yeah,
before next month, so we all come here.
We can
here,
all talk
it.
And discuss, and then we can choose what we want to submit. That would be.
I think we all deserve medals. The public doesn't understand a bit of what you guys go through month after month after month.
Well, thank you for bringing up. I think if it weren't for you, we wouldn't have been discussing
getting
those.
Past my bedroom.
You know, I've been here.
And well, I have a ride out there. But I have to tell you one more thing. I grew up with Jack St. John.
Can do what they want.
This scar is when I punched him in the mouth in 1932.
I'm Scott. True. That's so true.
Can I?
Yeah, so I'll get.
Okay, so we'll work together. I'm around now. My vacations are done. I'm
and
back
I will
in town.
And I will look for that. Maybe it got caught in my spam file.
It's okay. We can distribute that too, but I'll also distribute. Some sample legislation.
Yeah, okay.
One of the things I think that's effective too, if New Paltz put a big sign in the parking lot at ShopRite, I thought it says, do you have your bag with you?
Yeah, but that's in the town.
But that's in the town. it
is in the town, but it's to remind you to bring your bags with you.
That's a great idea.
And it might be good for the county to invest in some signs that's like that, just to put in the parking lot.
It's a great idea.
Yeah. On the bus. Especially because it takes the onus off the retailers to enforce their own law. So just that they can say, I can't sell you cigarettes. Look, they don't let me sell them to you.
Right,
they can do the same thing with bags,
where
they can just blame you instead of having
to
have
them.
We're the bad guy. We're the bad guys. Plenty. Quick. All right. Any more questions? I mean, are you okay with this?
Yeah.
With us moving forward.
I think that's
with
a good plan for next week.
Next month. Yeah. Next week we could do it too.
Hey, I'm having a good time.
That's a pretty element.
The what?
Thank you both for taking the time and.
Thank you. Is that so? If you guys want, can you maybe come to next month if you if you want to, or we can get it to you ahead of time so you can see.
Yeah,
if you can't come, you can have.
I'm not sure if I'm here. But.
No big deal. Well, if not, you can have comments.
Yeah.
Do you know what date it is?
It's the second Tuesday.
Monday.
Second Monday in the month.
I'm probably.
It's this. I think it's this. Oh no.
Yeah,
oh,
it's
Labor Day.
Labor Day. No, it's not.
Labor Day.
Yeah.
No, it'd be the 13th.
Yeah, so that's why.
No. We're going to be moved. We're going to be moved because we'll fall on
September 12th.
I think.
No.
No, 5th is Memorial Day.
Yeah.
Labor Day.
Yeah, that's the first one. That's my other committee meeting.
Oh.
Yeah. We'll let you know.
Okay.
No, you guys probably wouldn't be meeting.
I have it on the 12th.
What's today's date?
I have it on the
8th. It
will be the 12th.
Yeah.
That's
what I said.
Rich, you had it the first time.
Yeah.
I was nodding my head at you saying, you got it.
I believe it's the 12th.
It's the 12th.
Exciting.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks for everything. Okay, so now we're going to do. The approval of the minutes from July. Anybody have any questions on those?
Move it.
Second.
Mary, second. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, the resolutions.
Do you want to bundle these?
Yeah, just say, except for the last one. Do you want to bundle them? They're pretty cookie cutter.
That's okay.
All in favor, Jonathan? Mary, second. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
358 to 362.
Yep. Okay, now, John, this is the 365.
So you moved to bundle them, and then did you move to?
Oh, no, we have to do
and
that.
Then we have to pass them.
All right, move to pass bundle.
Oh, yeah.
Second.
Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, John, John's been legislated.
So the memorializing resolution, I've talked to the other members here about this coming down the pipeline because traditionally our memorializing resolutions last 2 years. It's been longer than that. So, and we're actually at a pivot point here where Entergy, who owns Indian Point, is currently in the process that's been delayed in requesting another 20-year lease on the two remaining reactors. We were very particular and how we worded our resolve, especially, because of the reality is that we're not setting, you know, an immediate date or time. We're asking for all involved parties to come together and begin to have a legitimate discussion. And the idea of having a 20-year extension does nothing but stall that. We're talking about, you know, both socially impacted parties, economically impacted parties, and environmental representatives to all come together on the state and federal level. But with a 20-year extension where you have dozens, now up to I think about a dozen since the time we even submitted this, and we're writing this on planned shutdowns, while our county seat sits, as the resolution says, within 50 miles of the peak injury zone, there's multiple levels of why another 20 years of delaying this issue in our backyard isn't appropriate for our residents. So that's why we put forth this. And this, the main receiver of this will be the Federal Regulatory Commission as they continue to mull the 20-year extension for Entergy.
Yeah, John wrote this. I'm co-sponsor on it, but I'm really happy with the language, especially of the resolved. I think it's very considered, asking to urge toward a transition plan. I mean, that is the focus of it, rather than the immediate shutdown. I think it's interesting because, Rich, you and I were there through all the years that we discussed this through previous legislator, and now we're, you know, it's almost as if we're full circle. It's not exactly that it's a straight line, but now to have the reality of shutdowns due to bird poop, you know what I mean?
Can I ask a quick question? What does the local community feel about it? Where it's in.
In Buchanan?
Buchanan, Westchester County. What?
I think, this is just my personal opinion from folks I've talked to, is that because of the way it's been approached in the past, there hasn't been a collaborative approach to this. It's been one side's been turn the switch on and leave it on versus turn the switch off. There hasn't been any type of true, every single partner coming together and building a plan.
But, I mean, do they pass a resolution opposing it? I'm just curious.
I don't know about the
only because we're always
towns,
big into home rule. Like if Buchanan wants it open.
Well, was it 2 or 4 years ago the legislature, Westchester County as a county, has opposed the continuation of Indian Point. And I know Legislator Donaldson, Legislator Rodriguez, and when I was doing research for this, I found it, that we have in the past joined in supporting Westchester County's petition to have it closed.
I definitely support the concept of home rule in general. I think that this, we can consider, it's not just about the host to the plant. You know what I mean? Given that we are in the 50-mile radius, and I don't know. I mean, I remember pretty clearly when we got the presentation about the evacuation routes, and also being someone who flies over it a lot and sees just what you're dealing with. It's pretty frightening, given that we're coming off of Fukushima. I don't want to be alarming, but we're coming off of Fukushima, where our fish in this country is totally contaminated off of something that happened in Japan. So,
You know what? At the end of the day, it's because of us.
Yeah.
You know, we didn't demand these and need electricity, cars, need to fly planes. You know, so at the end of the day, the demands, they're there because of us. They're not there because just to feel, to hurt the environment.
Which is why we need a plan.
But that's the problem.
A transition plan.
And we've talked about the reality of current plans and the reliance on nuclear energy because it's the reliance on subsidies. Mm-hmm. These plants, mainly it's plants right now in western New York, but it's a trend in nuclear. It's the they're not make making money. Now they're being subsidized with ratepayers.
Yeah, but I thought nuclear was, they're starting to go back to nuclear. Because nuclear is cleaner, it's cheaper.
They just gave a $7 billion subsidy to nuclear.
Everything gets subsidies, though.
Well, no, but when do eventually, but this is
what does it get subsidies?
But when is it, do you look to, when is it start time to developing a plan where you don't rely on, especially the fact that the pure location of, the location is the number one.
No doubt.
And it's also, but it's the development of a plan, that when do we start taking these, that now it's actually started at $2.5 billion, it's gone to $7 billion, and it keeps rising in just the plan alone.
I know.
When do we start repurposing it to make sure that we're retraining workers, you know, we're retraining, you know, the workers in that facility to now be the next workers for a wind farm off of the Long Island Sound, which they're now proposing. When do we, you know, it's different.
You know what, Jonathan, and I'm going to let Mary go, but they had a proposed wind mill in Denning, and the county planning board voted it down. So you know what? Nobody wants anything, whether it's nuclear, whether it's solar panels, whether it's wind farm. Nobody wants anything. They want nothing. In Cape Cod, they want the wind farms out in Cape Cod Bay, and the Kennedys are suing because they don't want to look out over to Cape Cod Bay and see wind farms.
But I know there's been a lot of positive support for the proposal on Long Island, including...
That's amazing. I'm glad. But, I mean, it's just
a word. Yeah. I mean, there is concern about total distance, but it's been met with a lot of positive... But, it, you know, it's...
Good.
It's the state coming through. There was actually a great editorial news day about it. Yeah.
Well, I saw about the wind in this area in particular that one of the downsides is our... Most of the wind currents, Lake Out West or in the Midwest, are more, you know, steady. Mm-hmm. And ours are the speed is, and it burns them out much faster.
And that may be fine, but if somebody wants to build one, who cares?
No, I don't. I know. I would be for them.
Who cares?
It's
not a reason for a neighbor to be against it because
That could be a reason why you would choose not to do it, but not. Right.
Right.
Exactly.
But that didn't come because the neighbors didn't want it.
Exactly.
And the county planning board didn't want it.
I was only going to say, I agree with the home rule too, but in this case, it actually affects everybody outside of.
Yeah, I agree.
So that's.
I agree. I'm fine with it.
So it was moved by Heppner, seconded by Bartels.
All in favor? Any more discussion? All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Carried.
Thank you.
I won't change my vote like the memorializing resolution vote.
But don't talk about it.
What?
And everybody supported it in caucuses, and then the next week on the floor, half the people voted against it. Who said they were going to support it?
I didn't. I said I
voted against it, but I never was definitely.
You never asked me
I
any
said
questions.
I was more likely to vote against it if it was a complete ban on memorializing resolutions.
Yeah.
What if we were going to have them?
Yeah, no. Believe me, I'd be for that, but
some kind of Nassau County does it.
They ban it.
They ban memorializing resolutions.
Oh, they do?
Yeah, unless it's specifically related to an Ulster, like if it has like Ulster County will become a county that support like every April's Cancer Awareness Month. You can do that as like because you're setting a county policy on it.
And the state has a policy about them too. Yeah. I did a research thing on it. Like that's where we got the idea of just doing the letters and having people sign off. Some counties just do that.
Yeah.
Well, you know what?
Different counties handle them differently.
My thing is, I've just and Tracy's been around a long time. I've never really seen a memorializing resolution do anything. To be honest with you, you know. And you know what? I've spoken to couple of state legislators, and it's like, think about us when you keep getting emails from the same person. After a while, you kind of dismiss them as saying, yeah, big deal, it's another one. Not big deal, but you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
And coming from us, it's really not much of a difference because it's what do they want again? What do they want again? They're, you know, I don't know.
No,
so to me...
And we did spend a lot of time, which was your biggest complaint.
Yeah, right.
The question. The time is understanding.
Yeah, okay. We can go over Manna's thing next month. Is that right?
Yeah, it was really just it's just like an update on the activities, and they fixed the overview to match current term. Like that,
and we have
the environment committee when they started that wasn't even called the Energy and Environment Committee. So they just like changed basic, you know, things as long as with an update. But she can explain it.
Yeah.
And solid waste is where we're finalizing their report, getting closer. I mean, there's not it's.
And then next month we hope to have EMC, right?
Yes, Dave Holderman was here today, the chair of the EMC, but okay. he just wanted to observe.
He'll probably never want to come back again.
I really recommend him.
He looked really good.
But I think I'll ask him if next month works for him. They had no July meeting, so he didn't want to come to a meeting, which ended up being good because it was such a long meeting anyway. Mm-hmm. So I'll just confirm with him, and then once I confirm with him, I'll confirm with you and Colin. And
can we send Riverkeeper and Mr. Kelly just a note thanking for coming out tonight?
Fawn, thank you.
Thank you for arranging
politically. You put in the publicly. Thank Fawn for doing all the work getting these folks doing over and above. And
it was very helpful.
Coast Guard said they wouldn't come. I was really like, how are we going to find out anything about it? And then when I read the article in the paper that mentioned him, I just took a wild guess and called him. And he called me right back.
That's great.
Like 5 minutes later. And he's really very eager to, you know, like he says, even if there was no oil in the river, he's just worried about having a place to park. Or just
now,
parking.
Senator
Gillibrand,
I think. Her office, I spoke to Susan. She called me to see if Coast Guard wasn't coming, they would have reached out to him. And I said, you know what?
Yeah.
We've got enough for today, for this first meeting to kind of digest it. And if down the road we feel, you know, we'd like to have them come in, then we'll ask for your help.
And that was the best part, because I think that was my original purpose, is I wanted to learn more about it.
Yeah.
It was just until Mr. Ford.
You know what? It's interesting.
Isn't that amazing to go for Mr. Ford? So he showed up at that.
Although Dutchess County passed a resolution a couple months ago, I think.
But I don't feel like it was on our radar. And so, I mean, and that was just a public comment at session.
Mullinaro's
been
really
calling very different.
He wants the hearing.
Mr. Kelly had.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
No, but I mean, if Mr. Ford hadn't brought it up.
Yeah, no. But he makes a good point, though, is because the last time we had an issue like this with the federal government, it was the capacity zone. And all they did was file the online comment.
They passed that?
Yeah, and now we're paying for it.
But
they just, like, they did the whole online comment thing, and people were really up in arms, but then they never heard anything, and it was done. And
right. Okay. Motion adjourned. All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you
for letting the meeting run.
Yeah, no, they were good.
It was good.
I knew when the public was going to speak, they were just going to have.